Good morning.
Good morning.
How's it going?
It's going well.
Good.
How are you doing, Rob?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Yeah, no, it's good. You working this coming week?
Monday, and that's it.
That's it? Yeah, I've got
Yeah.
3 days. 3 days and then 4 days off, which is nice.
Yeah, that's good. So Chris is still spinning, but
Uh-oh.
everybody else looks there.
Hi, Joseph.
Hello, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad. A little groggy, but other than that,
Groggy? Too much to
yeah.
drink last night.
It was
No.
the Depeche Mode concert. He just
it was a Depeche Mode concert.
Wow.
I've got a music hangover that's like
Nice.
lasted a week. No,
Wow.
we just stayed up late watching TV,
What did you watch anything fun?
Well, oh my God, we were watching Hotel Rwanda for Sophie's class, which is not fun. So then
It's
to
a comedy, isn't it?
Oh God, no.
No. I'm joking. I know it's not a comedy.
And then cause she missed school on Friday, so she was trying to get it watched, so we watched the first half of that. And then to kind of like ease ourselves to bed, we ended up watching Ted Lasso. But then, of course, we're like, oh, let's watch a little more. And so, you know
Wow.
how that goes.
Yeah, Ted Lasso is like that.
Yeah, it's hard to stop.
Like
So.
once you get going, it's like, I gotta do another one. Let's do another one. Let's do
I
another one.
know.
I'm
So,
that
yeah,
way
we.
with Yellowstone too, and those type of things.
I
I
need to
can't
see
stop.
Yellowstone still. I've heard it's really good stuff.
Well, any of the Taylor Sheridan stuff is great. Like it's really
Gotcha.
good. Even the Tulsa King, that's really good. The Sylvester Stallone one.
Is that a spin-off too?
No, that one is
Okay.
sort of like a gangster going to Oklahoma. So
Gotcha.
he's an ex guy mobster coming out of prison. But
Nice.
it's pretty good. It's really good. But the ones that are related is the 1850 something and the
Right.
1920. Yeah.
Yeah, I knew there was like multiple shows that go
Yeah.
together. Yeah, we'll get to
Chris,
it at
did you
some
make
point.
it?
Hello, I'm here.
Okay. Hi. I think Mike was
Welcome.
trying to add me to call at the same time I was trying to join the call. So we were ringing at cross purposes.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. How have you guys been?
Good.
Yeah, good. I'm my immediate like my my wife and my kids, we're all doing great, but found out last week my parents both got COVID and my brother and his entire family had COVID. They did not get it from each other because they hadn't seen each other in person
Yeah.
for a
Does that
little bit.
change your
So
Thanksgiving?
we are keeping an eye because now my brother and his family usually go to my sister-in-law's side of the family, so that's just been canceled. They're just going to stay home.
Yeah.
My brother and my niece are pretty much almost over it, but my sister-in-law ended up getting it late from those two, so she's right in the middle of it right now. So they're going to do their own thing, but like I said, that doesn't change our plans. My parents seem to be getting over it, so I think we'll be fine for Thursday. Really, it's just they come over and my wife's mom and brother come over. It's just a really, really small little gathering. So we think we'll be fine, but I got to call them today again and see how they're feeling. Haven't talked to them since Friday, so.
Is that the first time a lot of them have had it, or?
First time that my parents got it, so they've avoided it for 3.5 years, and
Yeah.
now here it is. I want to say for my brother's family, it might be the third time for at least my brother and his wife.
Wow.
It's at least the third time for those two. I'm not sure if Paige got it every time. I want to say the first time she didn't get it at all, so this might be the second time for her. I've gotten it twice. The most recent time was this past January, which is like 6 months after I got it the first time.
Oh, jeez.
But both times, like, they get it bad. Like, my brother and his wife, they get it bad.
How much do you think going around kissing strangers has to do with it? At least, I mean, in your case, I'm, you know, not
for me, family members. Well, like, when I got it, you mean?
Yeah.
No, you know what the thing is, though? I have a habit of licking door handles, and this is probably not the best thing. I know you don't get it by ingesting, but, you know, my nose is right there too, so probably, you know. But anyhow, you know, they get it really bad. Like, the two times I had it, especially the second time, I honestly was one of the – if I didn't know it was COVID, because just some talking to people just made me decide to test and I was positive, I wouldn't even have known it was – like one of the most mild colds that I've ever had in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So thankfully, but yeah, I don't know. It's still around, I guess.
Yeah.
Never going away.
No, doesn't I think it's like just it. Like the flu. It's just going to be one of those things people get every so often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then in 20 years, we'll all see what the long-term effects were.
Somebody at work the other day is like, "Oh, I've got the flu." I'm like, "Fucking go home." Yeah. You don't show up to work and say, "Oh, I've got COVID." Why do you think it's okay to come to work and say, "I've got the flu. I just tested positive." Get out of here.
Yeah, nobody wants to catch the flu.
What is wrong with these people?
Especially before the holidays.
Right?
Right.
Yeah. I was like pissed. I'm like, she was in this room with the flu? Like, where's the mask?
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing how quickly everyone just reverted to the pre-COVID days.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I really thought at the beginning of COVID, that first, like, year, like, oh, my God, this totally changes how we're acting, like, for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
How silly of me.
We're all
back to exactly how we were before.
I hate to pick on somebody at work, but that just reminded me. There was another person on desk, and she said she wasn't feeling good. And I was like, "Are you going home?" She said, "Yeah." And she's like, "Well, I got to be at this party on Saturday, so I'll make sure I wear a mask." I'm like, "If you are so worried about the people on Saturday, wear a mask freaking right now." I do not. It's like you say, people have just gone back to bad behavior, you know?
Yeah, there was no learning experience at all with this.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Kind of like I'll stop. I was about to say something about politics. I'll be quiet.
Oh, don't.
But we don't learn. You're absolutely right.
That is for sure.
So I saw you didn't like Captain Marvel. Is that right?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of ho-hum. I thought Brie Larson... I thought she looked beautiful.
You know
what's
a bad movie, Mike? When you applaud the popcorn at
the... No, the popcorn is always great.
Yeah, but when that's the best thing you have to say about the movie, you know that you really did not enjoy that movie. Yeah.
Are you talking about The Marvels?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
there were some good scenes, but, like, it's just... I don't know if it's me. Maybe it's me, but... I'm just oversaturated with it right now. Like, even like with new movies, I can't even watch them anymore. Well, it depends on the movie. Like, we went to go see that. Oh God, what was it called? The Holdovers. That was fantastic. About those, it was like in the 1970s where a private school, a kid has to stay over the holidays with his professor and cook.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That was really good.
I've
been wanting to watch things like that, but not like big budget superhero. I'm not even excited for Aquaman, to tell you the truth.
Me
either.
I'll
probably go see it, especially because it's DC. But Barb wanted to see the Marvels more than I did. I was like, I'd rather go see Thanksgiving with the turkey killer. But
I can't tell if that's supposed to be a comedy or just horror.
Well, I don't know like if it came out of I don't know if it came out of Grindhouse, but Grindhouse in the previews in the middle, they had Machete and they had Thanksgiving.
Yeah. And they had the Nazi werewolves or something.
Yeah, they did. And then the Nazi turkey one too. So I think the Thanksgiving one was coming out of that, but
maybe.
Is it Eli Roth that did it?
I don't know. I haven't really researched it.
That's who did the trailer.
But having said that, I like going to the movies. Like,
yeah.
I mean, even if it's just for popcorn, and it was an enjoyable film. Like, I just didn't. It was a 3 out of 5. So it's just it's there, and there were some highs and there's some lows, and even like the things that are supposed to make you go like, ooh. You know, like
well,
I don't.
3 out of 5, you liked it then.
Yeah, I liked it.
It was
all right.
Yeah. Well, three out of five on your scale is not the same as a 3 out of 5 on Mike's scale, Rob.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think.
How hard he busts like, chops when you give something a 7.
I know, and a 7 is that it was a little bit more than I liked it.
I liked Miss Marvel. I thought she was great. Like, but I've liked Kamala. In the show, so.
We'll see it when it comes out.
Brie Larson looked beautiful. I thought she looked great. Like the actresses were good. I thought the acting was fine. Even the villain was fine. I just thought the plot was like, it didn't interest me. It was like a Freaky Friday, but not because it was just like let's blip in, blip out, blip in, blip out. Like I don't like at least with Freaky Friday and stuff. In those switch movies, they're switched for a long period of time, and they're in each other's bodies. Yeah. This one, they're not in each other's bodies. They're switching space. So like they're
switching where
jumping.
They are.
Yeah.
So were they trying to do the whole Rick Jones Mar-Vell thing without doing the Rick Jones Mar-Vell thing?
The Rick Jones Mar-Vell I'm not familiar with the Rick Jones Mar-Vell.
Oh, okay. So like Rick Jones would slap his bracelet or whatever, and then and then he'd flip places wherever Mar-Vell was at. Mar-Vell would be where Rick Jones had been at.
Oh, okay. The quantum band thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, they kind of did that. So maybe you could appreciate that a little bit because the quantum bands were definitely in it. So.
Okay.
Yeah,
because
I don't want to deter you away from seeing it. Like, I just, for me personally,
I
just rather see other stuff. And right now, I'm in old movie stuff. Like, I'm on my third Marilyn Monroe movie, and I'm watching Gator right now.
Didn't you watch, like, Cleopatra or something?
Yeah,
like
that was amazing.
I'm like, holy smokes, you're, like... you're watching old movies for sure.
Yeah, Cleopatra, I learned a lot too because it was one of those movies that I wanted to see. Was that true? Like I didn't know that Cleopatra had Julius Caesar's son. I had no freaking idea. There were like little things that were in that like they didn't grow into like strategically how Egypt played into it though. They were feeding a lot of Rome, you know, supplying stuff. And the fall of Egypt was sort of related to a volcano, I think, disrupting and stuff and stopping growth of food. Like, they don't get into that stuff, but they get in the romance. Like, they treat it like she manipulated Caesar so she could have a son, so she could rule more territory. And then when Caesar was killed... Mark Antony, she did the same thing with. So, like, even though I think she truly loved Mark Antony, I don't think she truly loved Julius Caesar, but who's to say? You know, who
can... It was a while ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago.
It's true.
And you have to understand, too, who's telling the what history you even know about it.
Yeah. The thing that's amazing,
like,
too, is...
who tells that history?
You know, Shakespeare did Caesar and showed how the Ides of March, how he was killed and all that. And seeing it here is like, what did those senators think? Like, we'll kill him And then everything will be cool afterwards. Like we'll rule as a democracy or whatever. No, they were all hunted down and killed.
Right.
So it's like I don't understand like what they all thought would happen. You have this loved icon, and I just don't know what was going through their minds. Like, yeah, we'll just take over and live like this. And then like Rome was split into threes, so it was, and then it was like, okay, this is the fall of Rome, right?
Interesting.
Yeah, it's because Julius Caesar's nephew took over, and Julius Caesar's son was, I believe, killed because they tried to put him like, they tried to hide him, but I don't think he survived. He did it in the movie, but I haven't done the research. In other words, historically, what in the movie they have the nephew who's Caesar's nephew. I forget, I can't remember what his name is, but he killed his nephew, a cousin, I guess. I guess you could say. Yeah.
Yeah, you've been enjoying a lot of those older ones, which that's pretty cool. I've got a list of like more like 70s movies that I've never seen that I really want to, like Dog Day Afternoon and All the President's Men, and like really, really famous and very, well respected movies that I just have never seen. I got to get around to some
Yeah,
of
I
them.
have
So Dog Day's freaking great.
I
yeah,
have
that's right here. Yeah.
Earthquake queued up,
It was
and
All the President's Men.
yeah, Bonnie and Clyde is another one.
that one's
What
good.
one?
Bonnie and
What's
Clyde.
the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
I
I
want
want to
to I
watch.
want to see that one too, because I've never
You
seen
should
that.
watch it back to back with the Sting.
Yeah. Okay. Because
Yeah.
Sting's another. That Sting's another one I've never seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, this thing is good.
Probably
I saw that
put
one
that on
like
my list.
recently.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere that because we were talking about if we did for Halloween, it's always a big deal in the youth services group. We've won, not to brag, but we tend to win. Even when we don't even freaking try, we tend to win. We were really lazy last year because I told them I didn't like doing dress up, so they literally all dressed up as different Joes, so that way I could just come as myself. But I had the ideas like, ooh, we should do Newman and Redford movies, and of course they only did two, so it's not gonna work because there's six of us. But they were gonna do Walk in the Woods, and then I guess Paul Newman died, and it ended up being I think Nick Nolte instead. So yeah, but yeah, you got the Sting and Butch and Sundance, and you can't get two better movies with two prettier men, that's for sure. It's good stuff.
I just put the other one on my list now, so gotta convince. You know what the thing is I gotta Stacey's gotta be in the mood for it, because I want to watch them together, and then we
Yeah.
also have to get the kids up upstairs to get ready for bed at a reasonable hour, because lately they've been staying up a little bit, and by the time we get downstairs they're like, yeah, I don't have 2 hours in me to watch a
And that's why I
movie.
probably won't see the Scorsese movie in the theaters, because getting Kristen to sign on for a 3.5 hour movie is not easy.
It's a
Yeah.
long movie. It's
Yeah.
a good movie, but it is slow paced.
Yeah, that's
Like
probably one we'll probably split over
it's
2 days at
a
home.
lot of heads talking and stuff, so
Yeah.
But Joe, that's the good thing about streaming it, right? Is that,
Yeah.
when it is something like that, you can break it up easily. Like you can watch like a couple, hour and half hour, 45 minutes or so, and then
Right.
watch the rest the next day.
Well, you treat it like a mini series in the old days, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. Guys, I just have to go off for a couple minutes. My dad just called and said to call him back. I just want to make sure everything's okay.
Okay.
Sure.
All right, I'm just going to go on mute.
All
So,
right.
Chris, I hadn't been on Instagram a lot. You still doing the Daily Marvels?
No, I haven't read a single comic book in like 3 or 4 months.
Get out
So,
of here. What are you going to cover today then?
just some movies.
Oh, okay.
How
Cool,
the
cool.
heck do you
Yeah.
do that? Like, how do you do that? I just don't understand how you could part with it.
Well, I'm not as into them as you are,
Yeah.
clearly.
It's like oxygen. It's like oxygen to me. Like it's.
Yeah. So yeah, I think for me now, it really is just an occasional. Like looking back over several years now, it is more of just an occasional. For a couple months, I'll kind of get interested in reading some. And but that's about the extent of it. I still kind of keep track of my reading just because it does. I do have curiosity about it. So that's how I can kind of know right off the top of my head that it's been a few months. Yeah, so looking, it was kind of like end of May, I got into it, and it was basically end of May. It was basically June and July, really. It was really just those 2 months. I read about 300, almost 400 comics over 2 months. But
well, you got in a year's worth of reading anyway, man.
Yeah, so yeah. I was reading like 30 to 40 comics a week, but that was a lot. Like, that was the most I've read. Like, even if I don't read anymore this year, that would be the most that I've read in years since like 2017. Most years, I've only read like 150 comics or so. 2017 was my last real big, like, into comics for a long stretch of time, from like April to August or so. Read like almost 700 comics that year. But yeah, I think I've just kind of settled into a different phase from my highs. I've been keeping track since 2014. Back then I was reading like almost 1,000 or more than 1,000 comics a year.
Yeah, I've never kept track of the comics. I do anything that's graphic novels or manga or books on Goodreads, and that's I hit a spot maybe a month and a half ago where I was like, I want to really like pound out some of this manga I've built up on my shelves. So I've been trying to do a book a day since October, so I've been down a real manga rabbit hole. I've been doing Fist of the North Star this last week, but I tend to rabbit hole. I don't, because yeah, I used to just read comics only, and then I got to a point I started realizing I'd build up so many graphic novels on the shelf and I just would never read them. And then I'll rabbit hole that for a while, and then I'll go, well, crap, I haven't read any books for a while, and then I'll read regular prose books for like a few months. But even then, I have the 20 or 30 comics that I get every month that I never skip. So I still have like those single issues that I, even when I've rabbit holed pretty hard on something, you know, I'm going to have my Superman comics that I read every month, bare minimum. But yeah, I get it. I do that with films and stuff too. I'll be like on a real movie kick for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read book. I've been reading books. I read books at night before bed sometimes, yeah. Other times.
What are books?
And do other things.
Yeah.
They're words.
Tell Mike about books. He read one.
I
he
did.
Liked them a lot.
Yeah, Joyland. Yeah,
Stephen King, Joyland.
Yeah.
Took him like 5 or 6 years to get through a 200-page book, but he got it done.
He did, and he liked it.
I actually marathoned the last 120 pages, like in a couple of days.
You did, because you started a long time before, yeah. And then all of a sudden you're like, yeah, I'm done.
But it actually goes to show, though, like what a good book. Like, I didn't feel like I forgot, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I didn't forget any of the stuff that happened, even though it took me 10 years. But I don't know. It's I remembered everything that happened at that amusement park up to
you enjoyed the story for sure.
Yeah, it's just... I don't know. I just, I would write. I don't have any time. That's the thing is, I'm getting
Yeah.
old. I don't have time. There's no time to do everything I want to do. So
Yep.
it's just, I'd rather devote the time that I do have to comic books because that's my thing.
I'm getting better
You
for
make your
that.
choices about the time that you have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I would feel like pressure, like I need to work on fill in the blank. And if you feel pressure to like read that book or read that stack of
You
comics or
don't
whatever,
enjoy it as
you don't
much.
enjoy
Yeah.
it. So
Yeah.
I've been really trying to like, okay, Joe, you're in a movie mood. Let stuff stack up for a while and just watch movies because that's what you want to do right now. And I've gotten better with that.
And that's what I did. Like this morning, I was like, I could read like I normally do, or I could watch Gator. And I was like, I want to watch Gator.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
I mean,
think we're better off doing what makes us happy and just enjoy ourselves,
Yeah.
That's entertainment, so
Yeah.
there's no shouldn't be any obligations. yeah, I mean, I so it's like I still like comics, but I like other stuff more most of the
Sure. You still play a lot of games, right?
Yeah, in those recent years, for the last like 6 or 7 years, that's probably the entertainment I go to most often.
Yeah, my son and I do a podcast, and he has really moved into being more of a gamer than a reader. And so now, instead of the way we used to do the show between that and school, he doesn't have time to read like we did. So I ask him every couple of weeks, you mind reading one comic, and we'll do a quick episode. And it's just a way for us to hang out. And 'cause unless it's Street Fighter, I don't really like video games. I like stuff I can like pick up like Injustice and like have a couple of quick fights then walk away from. I'm
Zach has
no.
finally discovered, well, not he knew that it existed, but started playing Fortnite a couple months
Sure.
ago, first time. We actually, when he was younger, we didn't let him play Fortnite, more with all
Yeah.
the social, all the people on there aspect,
Right.
than anything else. But now, we've got his account locked down and stuff, and he's just got three or four of his school friends and stuff that'll team up and play. So, but yeah, he just started doing that. That's the big thing now.
Yeah.
Still around.
That's like Roblox. If I had known what I knew about Roblox now, I don't know if I ever would have let the kids on there, but that box has already pretty much been opened, unfortunately. So you
Yeah,
just have
that's
to
how
keep
we
an
are
eye
with
on that
YouTube and
stuff.
them.
Yeah.
If I would have realized earlier on, if I would have thought ahead earlier on with YouTube, we would have made them stick with like the YouTube Kids.
Yeah.
But at the time, of course, they're so little, it's like all they want to see are like little, very little kid stuff.
Right.
And then they get older, 8, 9, 10, and some of the stuff that they might be looking at may not be quite appropriate for a 9 or 10 year old.
Right.
Don't notice it unless we happen to be in the room when they have it on.
Right. And you're like, what are you watching? Nothing. And they turn
Yeah, and
it
then it's like, well, wait a minute, what is this? No, you have to turn this off. And that's all well and good, but how many other things have they watched when I wasn't in the room?
Yeah, most definitely.
And it's not like they're trying to get away with something, they just don't know what they don't know.
Right.
Yeah. No, yeah, Fortnite, Roblox, those I think they appeal to a younger audience. Those were never ones that I got into.
Yeah, I agree.
Um,
Yeah.
sort
Yeah,
of.
Jack's doing Kingdom Hearts. He's really into Final
Oh, that's
Fantasy
fun.
and
Kingdom Hearts
Kingdom
is fun.
Hearts. So
Yeah.
those are the two he's been doing mostly, working his way through the whole series of both of them.
Yeah, I love Final Fantasy. Kingdom Hearts, I've never been much of a Disney guy.
Yeah.
I've tried a couple of the Kingdom Hearts and they didn't really appeal to me. Even though they do have that connection to the Final Fantasy series, but I do like the Final Fantasy series. That was what kind of, I mean, I think part of the reason I'm into gaming is I got, as a kid, I got real into Nintendo. But the Final Fantasy series was the series that you know, a friend of mine showed me one of the games and really blew my mind at the time. That, you know, prior to that, my understanding of video games was pretty action-oriented stuff, Mario, you know, shooter type things, Street Fighter, and I didn't really, until that, I didn't know that games could have a story and stuff like that, and that really drew me in. Mm-hmm. I think everything that I like and get into, I mean, some of the games, I do play some games that don't have much of a story, but I generally do gravitate toward games that have some kind of story. And I think, like, whether it's comics or movies or TV or games or anything like that, I think I'm mostly always gravitating towards and seeking out stories, you know?
Yeah, I'm the same as you, Chris, yeah. For sure. 99% of the games that I play is because it's got a cool story.
Yeah. Even if it's not the focus, you know, like I like there to be at least some kind of story that ultimately is being told from start to finish. So I think ultimately when it comes down to, that's what I really like, is just good stories.
Yeah, for sure. I got some stuck on one of the, not one of the main Kingdom Hearts. They have like Kingdom Hearts 1, 2, 2.5, of 2.5 or something like that. I'm literally on the last battle and I just can't beat them. And this was months ago. I just moved on to another game. So that one just sitting there. But of course, with my, like, you know, my analness is like, I won't go to the next Kingdom Hearts game.
Right.
Because I haven't finished this one. I'll go to a totally different game because I can't keep banging my head against the wall, but now I'm stuck on Kingdom Hearts.
Do you call the cheat line like they used to have back in the 80s?
God, I can't tell you how many times I used to call that thing when I used to play like the Dungeons & Dragons role-playing computer games and stuff.
Oh my gosh. Did your mom get the phone bill and go, Robert?
I wasn't excessive, but I definitely called the line a few times.
That's funny.
One thing, I don't know if this would satisfy you mentally, but there's been a couple times where I've run into that, where I get to the end of the game and the game's poorly designed in such a way that you'd have to do a lot of backtracking and stuff to like build up your character to beat the boss, or it's just the boss isn't really fair, like the way that they designed it or something like that, and I don't feel like dealing with all that. I've just gone on to YouTube and watched somebody else beat it and watch the ending way, and that, like, something about
feel like you actually seen it. Yeah,
I've seen it, and it removes some of my desire to accomplish it myself, and I can just move on to the next game or whatever.
It's not a bad suggestion. I don't know if it'll do it for me, but it's worth trying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Might get
that. It does get. I mean, honestly, I think I'm just not all that great at a lot of video games. I think that, Chris, if you happen to be like, if you were familiar with the game and played it yourself, you probably, and you were in the area, I could probably invite you over and you'd go on and probably be able to beat it. I'm just not all that great at a lot of them. But
yeah, that's okay. I mean, that's one of the things is games have become a lot more accessible, you know, with difficulty options. Like,
they have,
you know, I know, like, the Spider-Man games include just, like, a story mode, which is, like, you could probably just, like, pound your fists on the controller and not even pay attention. It's so easy, you know, but it's great for little kids.
It's like
great
mine.
That it's there, you know.
Yeah, they go on and they do a story mode. They don't have to worry, you know. If I'm having trouble, you can often change it in the middle of a game, you know. Some of the older ones, like the Kingdom Hearts, even though they might have settings, maybe you can't change it after you've started, or, you know, so you're right though. They've made it a lot different than I saw that they've just released the Atari 2600 Plus.
What does that mean?
It's a exact replica of the 2600.
Okay.
And it comes with one cartridge that has, I think, either 8 or 10 games on it.
Does it play the original cartridges though?
Yeah, it looks
okay.
Yeah, the only thing that's different is the back, so you could obviously plug it into a high def TV. And
right,
stuff
right.
Like that.
Right. You don't have that little switch.
No, and when you turn it on, it has the little Atari symbol on the actual console, like Lowe's. But other than that, it like looks exactly like it. But a lot of like some of the most popular games aren't necessarily on there. You know, it does have like combat and I can't remember Haunted House, Adventure, Yar's Revenge. It had like 8 or 10 games on there, but like they don't have Space Invaders. They don't have
Centipede.
A lot of the
Yar's Revenge was Activision, so I'm surprised they have that.
Yeah, yeah.
I had the one I got Kristen, God, probably before Jack was born, so that would have been like 2006, 2007, like the one that had all the built-ins. So it looks like one, but it actually can't take a cartridge.
It just has a
bunch on there, like 50 games or something.
And from what I understand, Mike, and don't quote me on this, but I did scan the article. I believe that it said that if you had Atari cartridges, they would actually work in the
yeah, that's what I was asking, because
it comes with the one that has 8 or 10 games on it, but then I believe it said if you still had your old cartridges lying around, you could. Yeah, it actually, now I'm remembering, it did say that, because somebody put in ET.
Yeah, because what's the appeal if you only have those 8 games?
Yeah.
It's only $130. It's like a nostalgia thing.
Yeah.
That makes sense then, because they've been doing the built-in systems for years now, the plug-and-plays. And the benefit of something like this is, yeah, you can get like other cartridges to play other games. So that's pretty smart.
It is, but, you know, I mean, I don't know how many people still have those cartridges, and if you do, are they still functional?
Yeah, and you just got blow on them, right?
Yeah, ours still works.
Playing something on the Nintendo Switch with the kids, and it was giving an, you know, they have, I don't know if any of you have a Switch, but they're these tiny, tiny, tiny little, like almost like SD cards that you put in, right?
Yeah.
So
they're really tiny.
Yeah, the kids put it in there and it wasn't working and they couldn't figure out. So Stacy grabbed it and blowed on it and put it in. It worked.
Get out. That's so funny. Yeah. That's like Chris was we had a scratch CD the other day and I was like, oh, I need to clean it. She says, no, you don't clean it. You just rub it on your jeans. I was like, oh my God, how did you ever work at a video store?
So the Atari 2600 Plus does play both 2600 and 7800 cartridges.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
If you have them. I mean, there are still retro game stores that sell
those.
Oh,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew this, Rob, but because the Switch cartridges are so tiny, they actually taste bad.
Really?
They were concerned about, like, kids ingesting them and stuff.
Yeah.
So if you put one in your mouth, which I've never tried, but you can, there's like YouTube videos of people doing this.
I'll have Allie or Zach try it later.
They actually swallow a $60 game. You're going to be mad though, buddy.
Well, they're old enough. They won't swallow it.
Yeah, but apparently they taste awful. They specifically made them. I don't know how they did it, but they made it so that they taste bad. So people, not people, but little kids don't. Yeah. If
that's
they put it in their mouth, they would take it out again.
Yeah, that's. I don't know why they're so ridiculously small. They just are asking to be lost.
Yeah,
they're tiny.
Yeah, they are really small. I guess. Yeah, they just. I think most of the people that make consoles, they really want to get rid of, they want to go all digital.
Yeah, they don't want the physical,
You know, and it's just a push and pull with consumers at this point. You know, they really would prefer to be all digital, but we're not quite there with the market yet.
Yeah.
That's what I think is so dumb. Like, you can go to Walmart and buy, I don't know, the new Mortal Kombat and get home and you open it. There's no disc. It's just a code. I'm like, why don't you just buy the freaking code from the Xbox store?
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, you can do that sort of thing. I don't get that.
I like the physical disc because honestly, like my neighbor had that. What is it called? The Star Wars Jedi. I don't know what I don't remember what it is, but you play this new character as he's like learning to become a kind of a Jedi. But anyhow, He happened to have for the PlayStation 4. So I have a PlayStation 5. If he had the digital version, I'm just out of luck, right?
You can
share that stuff, which is cool.
I probably don't want you sharing it, like Chris
said,
though.
They don't.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't want you checking it out from the library like kids do from us, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And there's no middleman. You know, they get all the money instead of Target or Walmart or something.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I typically do physical if I can. You can even sell it if you want to. And
that's another good point. Yeah, that's another great point.
But, yeah, they don't even really, like, even with the PS5, the discs just install onto your system. And then after that, the disc is just basically, like, DRM, you know, it's just, you just need it in the system for it to prove that you have the gaming,
have
but
it.
Otherwise it's not actually running it off the disc anyway.
Right, yeah.
I was going to say, I want to say it was the last system Jack bought, and I'm not super great with system names, but whatever the last Xbox was, I think he paid a whole lot more just so that it would actually have a physical disc drive on it, because I think in their one version of it where it doesn't even have a disc drive.
Yeah, the current ones too, they have two models, one with and with, actually both PlayStation and Xbox have different models, one with and one without, but you're not alone in being confused by Xbox naming system or naming scheme, though. Even
not gamers, quite as easy as the PlayStation one.
Yeah, PlayStation just like
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Four, it's like real simple. Like,
wait,
I don't know
what,
how
360,
long
then
up,
one, and then what's the new one?
It's like it went Xbox, and then Xbox 360, and then Xbox One. And now there's the Xbox Series X or Xbox Series S.
Jesus Christ, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's pretty awful. Everyone thought, like, oh, after the Xbox 360, they're going to do, you know, 720 or...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like what was it? It was Atari went, what, 2600, 5200, 78?
Yeah. At least they were going in the right direction.
Like, yeah.
A direction. You know, yeah. Jumping like
but each version 18. Sold less units, like terrible.
That's true. Yeah.
The only one that was successful was the first one.
Yeah. Hey,
and that was the one they had the open license where like Sears and Roebuck could have like their own version, right?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
It was like prescription drugs for video games.
That the new Xbox, whenever the new one comes, that it won't have a drive on it, a CD drive at all. I thought I read that somewhere.
There's rumors going around that they might even like discontinue the one that has a disc.
That's what sucks. They gotta have backward compatibility, I think.
Yeah.
Or at least have a plug-in so you can buy it if you want it.
Yeah. Well, it's getting to the point, like, not that I love lending people stuff necessarily, because I swear it's hit or miss if you ever get it back. But like if, you know, somebody's like, hey, I've never seen fill in the blank, and I'm like, oh, I got that. And then it used to be, well, at least they could watch it on their, you know, their gaming system. But yeah, it's getting to the point like even gaming systems aren't going to have like movie playing capabilities or CD playing capabilities eventually. So,
yeah, that's it's funny that you say that, Joe, because we were cleaning out like just the kids area and stuff, and found out that I don't know how, but somehow we have two Blu-rays of Princess and the Frog, the Disney movie, right? I have asked all of the kids that come over our house to play with ours if they would like it, and they have no idea what I'm talking about when I ask if they have a Blu-ray or a DVD player. They don't understand.
And they don't have
what I'm asking.
Yeah.
None of their parents, because again, I'm kind of old. None of their parents have any type of DVD players.
Well, they're that's the way for everything. Like, music is all digital. Movies are heading that way. Like, there's still the collector that wants their 4K and their Blu-ray, that'll always be there. But it'll be like a record thing, right?
Yeah.
And then comics, I think they want. I actually think the people that are in charge of the comics, not necessarily the people creating them, they want to go to that model. They want people just to subscribe to the app and then be done with it, and then you don't have any stores anymore.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think about, I'm going to put it in terms of wrestling. Think about wrestling went from being $60 a month for a pay-per-view to $10 a month for the app to however much to be part of Peacock. But they're getting so much money in ad revenue and from Universal NBC that they're still doing well, and they're probably hitting more eyeballs now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm this first time ever. I'm kind of, me and Mike, we talked about this a little bit last time we had a episode, but like for the first time, I really kind of sense, kind of feel like I'm not sure how much longer physical comics will be around.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really not. I mean, I'm not saying like it's imminent, but I don't know. I just am, maybe it's just me personally, but I just more and more that go to $4.99, it seems like that was the breaking point. It's like people aren't going to spend $5 on a physical comic book.
It's incredible.
$5 for a digital comic book.
Yeah.
Like the subscription thing, like Mike said, yeah, I can see that. But you're not going to get people to buy digital files for $5.
I think what's going to happen, it's going to be they're eventually, if it's going to survive as a physical medium, it's going to have to go like the manga / webtoons route, where people are eyeballing it and falling in love with it through the digital platform and then buying a physical copy once it's a bound graphic novel. Because that's, webtoons has been really successful with that, and so has, I mean, obviously manga has, it's having a resurgence ever since COVID. But I think that's what's going to end up happening. And that's, I think, where I'm going to start slowly moving to. And that's why in that one text I was talking to you, Rob, about why I want to support this new DC initiative that just popped up in the newest newsletter, where they're going to put the classics in the little cheapo formats. They're, what, $9.99 for the compact classics? I want to support that because I want it to succeed. I don't want it to go the way of the showcases or what have you. So
right.
I'm literally going to set aside $60 next month to make sure that I order one of each, because I like the idea of affordable physical books.
I don't like it because of size. Like, how can you fit a Watchmen with that much word balloons in a small size and expect a 55-year-old to read it?
Mike, I love that.
It's true. Well, Lone Wolf and Cub is the same thing of something that's already way too small for my eyeballs. But I'm still Watchmen. Yeah, I probably won't read that version. I'll read my old volume that I already have if I reread it.
No, but I accept the fact that everything they make is not for me.
Yeah,
even the
too.
Marvels, like it wasn't made for me.
Yeah.
If a ton of people enjoy it, bless them. You know, I'm glad. I'm glad it's out there so they can enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, like, just because things are getting smaller, like those Blue Ribbon Digests, I love to collect. I don't want to read them. Like,
yeah.
If I run across them, I'll buy them just so I can have a full set. But there's no way in hell I'm going to read them.
Yeah.
And the Digest, the Archie Digest, I just go to Comixology, and then you can blow up the panel and see it. Like, you can see it. And I got a new iPad, so it's like, I'm pretty late to, like, I always run things into the ground, just like my vehicles. Like, you last 25 years, you're good. My computer, you go 25 years, you're good. And then I get something new, but I finally got the iPad because my battery was just, I'd read two comics and then it was dead. I was like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah. But like exactly what you're saying, the manga, I could read everything for free just about on the apps, but I don't like reading those on my phone for what you just said. It's too small, because unlike Comixology / what's going to be Kindle soon, you know, it doesn't do panel to panel. Yeah. So it's much easier for me to get a volume of Jujutsu Kaisen than it is for me to try to read on the Jump app on my phone.
Yeah.
So I 100% agree with you. And that's a reason on that one where I actually really do prefer the physical, because it is easier for my old eyes than the digital version.
I I invested years ago on an iPad Pro because it's close to the same size as an actual comic book. And I absolutely. I mean, this thing's getting pretty old, but it's still working very well. So I'll definitely run it into the ground.
I'm getting used to like just doing it. So like, if it wasn't for my like DC compulsion, it's easier for me to do the Marvel on the app. Yeah. But I don't care really what happens because there'll always be comics there. Like I will always buy old comics, so it doesn't matter if the new stuff goes away of the Dodo, and it won't. It'll be digital, so I can always read the stories and follow that way.
Mike, it used to bother me that would be a possibility, and I don't know what it is, but it does not bother. Doesn't bother me at all.
It's probably your pocketbook.
No, you'll start.
I think that's a big part of it, Joe.
Yeah.
It's the $5. It's ridiculous. You go to the store and you notice it more at the store than if you buy it from DCBS.
Most definitely.
Because DCBS, like, you have the discount. Well, I still get a discount at the store, but I always sort my comics by dollar. And with the exception of Spawn, $2.99, there's like nothing $3.99 anymore. It's all $4.99. And it's like, he always tells, well, how many $2.99s? I'll have like two because I buy both covers. And then he says, well, how many $3.99s? I have like one. And then $4.99s, I have like 10. And then $5.99 and $6.99, like one or two. And it's like, good God. I mean, it's like... I'm even telling Ed. I mean, it's gonna be a downfall, and I've seen
how
it.
How is he doing? Rob's
computer.
I told you about my places.
Rob's comic store stopped business. Yep. Rob Liefeld's podcast. He had two stores in LA just close up. The Challengers guys that I listen to their podcast, they're suffering big time. The guys in LA and the comics conspiracy, they're hurting. They're falling back into pre-COVID numbers. Yeah. They don't complain about it as much, but if you just look at the people that are in the industry, you can see like what's happening.
Pulp 716 here closed. Chris, you saw that. Queen City, which honestly always is very. Even if things were bad, normally they just like to put on a front. Oh yeah, we're the best. You know, he had a conversation with me about how things have. It's never. He's never had to work so hard. His entire career, and this store has been around as a comic store since the 70s. So
they have to work four times insane. As hard because
yeah. He's
before
like,
it was.
Retire. He's
it was,
like, I can't.
Yeah,
retire.
It was 67. One distributor. And
I'm
now it's four. It's four distributors that have each and every their rules and bullshit. And finally, the variant covers are starting to sag.
For him, because I know him so well and know how he typically likes to present himself, for him to actually have a very, very serious conversation with me about how tough it is, that really opened my eyes because he's the last person that would normally admit it.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So well, not to be doom and gloom, comics will always exist.
Right.
But you might just be looking at it in a different form.
Right.
Yeah, it's been a slow death of the normal, of the traditional model, but it's definitely been a death that's just been really stretched out.
Well, even the creators, like Mark Millar, saying why... They're losing creators because they don't make that much money because their incentives kick in after they sell 50,000 copies. Well, guess what? They're not selling 50,000 copies.
No.
So it's like,
man.
Yeah, it's like, it's really, it's creators too. They can't keep the creators because their paychecks are not. And then they raise the price and then the consumer goes away. They're like, the speculators are going the way of the dodo too, and they're what kept the industry alive during COVID.
Yeah. Well,
without them.
There's
And they always go away, and it's never a solid foundation for
that's right
the industry.
I think Chip Zdarsky does a podcast where they he's kind of like the new guy learning about manga called Mangasplaining. And I know some weeks they'll be on there and they'll pick a series that either is really deep or like, you know, just an expensive volume. And he'll be like, I don't make that kind of money. And that, and to me, that's depressing. You're talking about a guy who's writing the biggest title that there is right now. And who just came off this huge, very popular Daredevil run, and he's worried about a $20 book, you know?
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, yeah. That tells you they don't make enough money.
Yeah, I think they're mostly in, you know, either that's they're well established and it's, you know, a matter of routine at this point, or, you know, or that's just. There's just true love there for the medium, because otherwise if it's more of kind of a, they just like to write in general and don't really care about the medium. You know, speaking of writers, not artists, obviously, but for writers, if they're happy to write in TV and have an opportunity to write in TV, they're going to jump at that because the money is way better.
Yeah. Think about Geoff Johns. That's probably why Justice Society takes forever to come out, because he's got his toes in so many different swimming pools, because that's how he keeps his finances going, I'm sure.
Well, I think he spends a lot of time now not even writing, but producing.
Yeah.
Whatever that job is, I don't understand it, but there's a lot of work financing stuff and moving money and granting money and saying yes, you can do that.
Yeah, and getting money, I'm sure, just, you know, getting people to like commit to things so that he's raising money all the time. Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah,
sort like of I contributing also like an overall vision to like saying, like having like the creative vision to say, yeah, that's a good idea, that's a bad idea, you know.
But isn't it a trip that somebody who's so big in DC, you know, the stuff that I think outside of the Justice Society that's so personal to him, he's like having to outsource to somebody else. Like, he can't even get his own publishing house to publish it. That trips me out. But whatever.
Yeah.
It's a weird industry, and I swear it keeps getting weirder. Very weird.
That's why I would never be in it. Like I think it would destroy my love for the medium. I really do.
I think it's so weird. Like with Disney, you've got how many publishers that actually print Disney stuff? You've got Fantagraphics, Dark Horse, Dynamite, Marvel, and then all these other like subsidiary like things like Abrams and all these stuff that I don't even know that are in the back half of the catalog, and I'm just like. It's so weird. You have a publishing arm. You have Hyperion. You have Disney Books. You have Marvel. But you outsource all these characters. It's so weird to me.
It's because they know that's the money's not there.
Yeah.
They know the money's in the marketing, so they rather have somebody else take the weight of the publishing.
Yeah. They must. They actually must make.
That's why there was a lot of consideration of
than if they did them themselves.
DC licensing their characters to Marvel.
Yeah.
And they did that back in the day, too, when Shooter was around. DC went to Marvel and said, do you want to publish this? And Marvel turned them down. Jim Shooter said yes, because he thought he could make money. Like, he showed them money numbers, and it wasn't Jim Shooter. It was the people with the pockets that said, no, I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. Because they were making all kinds of, like, things like, well, you guys suck at marketing. We can help you market, like, so you could have t-shirts. You know, there's Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman stuff. That's where the money is in the marketing. Right. And there were at the time when Shooter was around, he was like, they can help us with the marketing. Like, we're not marketing as Spider-Man and Hulk as much as we should be.
Right.
And
that's true.
That's what they offered them, and they turned it down. And Jim Shooter says that was a mistake because they. Think they could have done wonders with it.
I wonder too if it's partially because, like, if they develop a storyline for Captain Marvel, that can be something that can get developed into a series for TV or film, whereas like Stitch at Tokyo Pop and Dynamite, whatever they do there is probably never going to see like celluloid. Does that make sense?
True. Yeah. But I think Disney does have a oversight to make sure Dynamite doesn't put Vampirella in Lilo and Stitch.
Dude, oh, they certainly do, Mike, I'm sure.
If they did, I'd be all over it. But
Barbarella means Stitch, I'm buying that issue. Oh, man. Hades and Red Sonja next month.
Oh, heck, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I'd be all over that.
But I'm sure they have, like, we don't want to – they have to play within the rules, and they probably submit, like, their stuff to Disney like anybody else.
Oh, for sure. Yeah,
like the Conan stuff and everything, and, you know. Yeah. That all has to go through whatever it is, anytime it's licensed.
Yeah,
oh my God,
Joe.
They could have Scar and Sheena. I'm building this whole Dynamite Disney universe.
Oh my God, you gotta pitch that. You might find yourself a new job, Joe.
Right.
I actually like those villains ones. Like I'm enjoying them. They're like a really artistic thing. Like they're getting some really good artists to do this stuff.
Yeah, and Jack did Hades on the last episode we did, and I was like, holy crap, I need to be reading this. So
yeah. I haven't read Hades yet, but I was very happy
it's gorgeous.
Maleficent and Scar.
Yeah.
Scar was great, and I forget what the other one was.
Oh, they got a Cruella de Vil one coming out soon.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
One after another.
But I haven't been able to get into the other things they're doing, like Darkwing Duck and like all
Gargoyles.
The stuff. No, Gargoyles.
I still
get. Nostalgia
for any of that stuff. That was after.
Either
my
do
time.
I. Either do
yeah,
I.
It's old.
But the comics are really good.
Yeah.
I don't. I have. I was reading Maleficent, and I'd never seen her in a cartoon. I don't know what it is.
Well, I knew her from
Sleeping Beauty.
From Sleeping Beauty.
Watched Lion King, and I'm reading.
You
Scar.
Never watched Lion King?
No, never did.
Me and Stacey used to go see all the Disney ones.
No, even, name the cartoons.
No kids, we used to go see those.
I stopped seeing Disney around the time Snow White, Cinderella came out.
Well, no, you're not that old.
You haven't watched Disney since the 40s?
That's right. And that was like a remastered version of it. So.
That's funny. I got a Gargoyles figure right next to me. That was like one of those shows that was on when I was in college. I really liked Gargoyles. That was good stuff. That was back in the Disney and Batman animated series and Earth Gym. All that stuff was like on in the afternoon.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that I was still in cartoons in college because the good stuff like Justice League and Batman were showing.
Yeah.
And you could tell that I wasn't. Apart from Batman, which I had seen some episodes of, I feel like that was a little bit before any of the other ones, but maybe I'm wrong. But I did see some of those. But as Mike, you definitely know. Joe, I don't know if you know. Chris, you do. I never watched any of the X-Men animated series.
Yeah,
it's like I was already too old. I wasn't watching any cartoons at that point.
Yeah. You missed out, man.
I recorded every single one on my VHS, and I watched it.
Wow.
It was a good cartoon, man. It was really good. It kind of flowed with, if you were a Spider-Man as Amazing Fans, or Amazing Fans, Amazing Friends. I was an Amazing Fan. But,
there you go. Bring it back around.
I liked that.
I
so
would say
it was
you
like,
could qualify
I,
for that.
I followed
that qualification. Like.
I followed it. Incredible Hulk. I followed the X-Men. And I followed Batman and the Justice League Unlimited. All that
Wildcats?
Stuff. Wildcats, I didn't watch. Savage Dragon, I'm just
Savage
watching
Dragon.
Now. Yeah. Just watching it now. I hadn't That's seen it. Funny. It's actually not bad. With the exception of Dragon's voice, which I find terrible for Dragon, like it's not like deep or like I expect Dragon to be like this badass dude, and his voice in that cartoon is so high pitched that I just don't like it. But as far as the characters and the stuff that happens in them, they're good episodes.
Yeah, where are you seeing that? I would like
that
to
was
see Savage
that
Dragon.
Was on the NBC thing. Now I think it's on Tubi.
Okay.
Yeah. But we're talking about voices we don't like. I'll do a confession. I always hated Rogue's voice on X-Men 92. It always drove me crazy. That raspy, hey, sugar. I'm like, oh, God, stop. I hate bad Southern accents with a passion.
I liked it. Like, I, having being not from the South at all, I right. thought, you know, it was like exposure, you know. Gambit's accent and her accent.
Oh, yeah, the Gambit.
I just thought all of them, like, hearing them now, they just all of them sound so bad.
Yeah, they do to me too, buddy. I hate Rogue so much.
Not having any of that, like I saw it when, you know, in the 90s, it just doesn't, it just
But that's like, what's her name, Pretty Woman, Julia Roberts, when she did the Southern movie, her Southern accent is horrible. And I'm like, and you're from Atlanta, you should do better. Like, my color is pink and pink. I'm like, oh my God, please stop.
Was she doing that on purpose, do you think?
Oh, she had to have been just laying it on thick, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but like I say, she was Southern. She should sound Southern,
right?
It seems like the ones that can do accents are all European.
I agree.
Like, they're English actors, and they can like they're very versatile in their accents for sure. It's like when you hear them on the movie, and then you hear them on a live interview, you're like, that's the same person.
Oh
like,
yeah, when they do,
how
like,
do they freaking do that?
When they do American accents?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Or even sometimes just
it's like, wait, what? Like, you hear them in an interview, like, oh, my God, what? What? That is insane.
Yeah, I didn't know they were from New Zealand. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were you saying, Chris?
I think part of that is, you know, you think of the size of the UK compared to the size of America, and there's probably more variations of English accent or as many variations of English accent as there are of American accent. And
it's kind of crazy when you think about it.
A much smaller
yeah.
place. Like,
yeah.
It really kind of varies. You know, you have your Cockney, you have your other Southern, you know, you have. And there was also a history in the UK of with the BBC, something called received pronunciation, where for decades, you know, if you were on the BBC, you spoke English in a certain way. You had
properly.
To.
Yeah,
you know, and yeah, so I think it might be a little bit more of their training as actors is it's inherent to it to, you know, it's like, well, you're in the show, you're playing a character from, you know, this part of England, so you know you need to sound like you're from that part of England, not just not from where you're actually from.
Here's just
that's
one exception that I have to. This is a huge pet peeve of mine. And now I've experienced it two different times. It drives me insane. So there's this book, Joe. I don't know if you've read it. All the
somebody getting their
see.
Teeth cleaned or somebody.
I think somebody's vacuuming somewhere.
It sounds like somebody.
Sorry, I'm mute. That's in my background.
Oh, I was like, it sounds like somebody's getting blasting their sonic teeth cleaner. Like when I'm at the dentist. I was like,
so my huge pet peeve, Joe. Have you read All the Light You Cannot See, or are you aware of it?
I know of it, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I haven't
great,
read it.
Great, fantastic book. They did a 3 or 4 part adaptation on Netflix that just came out.
Okay.
So it's about this blind French girl and then her dad and uncle and stuff like that during World War II when the Nazis occupied France. Really, really good book. But anyhow, watching it, I'm like, what do? They changed. Why do they have to change this? Right. Everyone, all of the Germans, all the people playing Germans, all have a German accent.
Mm-hmm.
All of the other people, like the blind girl and stuff, they all have British accents. So I'm like, why did they have to move this? This doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Oh, no, they didn't move it. Show it's set in France.
You're right.
Why are they all having British accents? And it drove me. That drives me insane. My parents, we used to pick a movie once a month. Like my mom would pick one, my dad would pick one, I would pick one. It's before the kids came. Sure. They picked Les Mis that one time with, I don't know who's even in it anymore.
Liam Neeson, I think.
Yeah, they all had English accents the entire time. Like, what is going on? I don't know why. Huge pet peeve of mine, but it happened again. Like, I don't know why they can't have French accents.
I think that's in journalism too. Like if you're in broadcast news, they are taught to speak with a Midwestern generic American accent as well, because I remember that was in like a David Letterman interview, you know, like you were supposed to talk like you were from the Midwest if you're going to be in broadcasting.
And they don't have a pronounced accent, right?
Right. And that was one of the first things I learned at the radio station is like, you don't say W, you say, you're listening to WPGA. It's not W, it's W, like two words, you know, and that's the first thing they taught me. And so, you know, and you got to get out of like the regional accents, and if you're supposed to be doing like broadcast news and that sort of thing.
Interesting. So you
that's
think,
why everybody sounds generic.
But why? So why do you think that they don't do a French accent for people that are playing French?
I don't know.
And yet the Germans all have German accents.
And that's maybe it's historically that you hear German, that's the baddies. I don't know. That's a very good question.
I had seen now nothing about this new series, but I had seen, I went back because I'm like, after I watched this series, I'm reminded of Les Mis. So I went back and I was searching stuff on that, and I saw an interview that the director said, no, we can't have them at French accents. It makes it seem like it's comical.
Oh, like you're z,
I guess,
you know, like
you're
picking
French
fun.
Accent. I yeah, can do that, but if you were,
right.
You they know, have it in Pink Panther.
Ridiculous, but,
go watch,
you know,
a Peter Sellers movie.
Right. Yes, exactly right. Yeah.
So, you're watching, what's it? Is it Better Off Dead? She's like, this stupid pig Ricky and his mother. You know.
There you go. Yeah, I guess they've all heard too many really bad French
accents. Yeah, maybe that's what it is. And they think that's going to take the piss out of it. And whereas, like, if you're doing a British accent, you know, that's... That's
very
the gold standard. That's why, like, in the Star Wars movies, originally everybody spoke with a British accent, right? Even Carrie Fisher. So, I don't know.
Yeah, interesting, huh?
It is.
All right, you
I
guys
want to... a book.
Yes, do it. Let's kick us all off.
Right. I read this a couple of weeks ago, so God knows if I'm going to remember any of it, but I thought it was topical since... I had it A right in front of me, and B, Mike just saw the Marvels. So they did a reprint for Trick or Treat this year, Trick or Read Free Comics Ages 13 Plus, and they reprinted Captain Marvel number one, the Kelly Sue DeConnick Dexter Soy edition. So opens up, they're fighting Absorbing Man. It's Captain America and Captain Marvel, and you know, they're pretty much taking care of business, but then they're worried that, you know, anything Absorbing Man can catch or touch, he can turn into, and he's about to catch Cap's shield. So Carol's like, that can't happen. So she jumps in. She uses her sash, which, you know, always seemed basically decorative, but they decided to come up with a use for it. She covers his face with it. She pounds the crap out of him, and she takes him out. So later on, they're back at Avengers Tower. So this must be, let's see, this was 2012, because I looked at it and it just fit our timeline to be able to be covered.
She was a consultant on the film. Kelly
was
Sue DeConnick,
really?
Yeah.
Nice.
I saw her
well,
in
good,
the credits.
Because she basically pretty much created this version of Carol, so that makes sense. But, yeah, so this is, I think, during the Bendis runs when everybody was in, like, the Avengers Stark Tower or what have you. So they're talking about debriefing after the big fight with Absorbing Man. And apparently this is a talk that Steve has had with Carol many times. He's saying, you really should take the name. And she says, but it's not my name. And he's like, you are a captain. And she's like, stop, Steve, Captain Marvel's dead. And I want to go, no, she's fine. Monica's still running around. But for whatever reason, they ignore Monica Rambeau, which always pissed me off. But I think eventually, spoilers, further on in the DeConnick run, they finally do have a sit down, come to Jesus moment where she's like, you took my name and you didn't ask me. That was not cool. So I'm glad it finally got addressed. It did not get addressed in this issue. But so anyway, she's like, Mar-Vell's dead. And he's like, his name actually wasn't Captain Marvel. It was Mar-Vell. You're a captain. Take the mantle. Peter shows up and she's got her new hairdo. And he's like, love your hair. And she's like, let's spar. And he's like, oh, shit. So she's kind of like pounding the crap out of Peter. You know, I've heard this many times about how they don't like Peter as an Avenger. And I don't know if I think of him as a team player, but whenever he's on the Avengers, I always kind of have fun with him because he gets to be silly. And he doesn't always get to be silly in his book. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, he gets to, like, say silly things during a fight. But I feel like he, during his Avengers run, he did get to be more happy-go-lucky, less Peter Parker luck, and, you know, just got to be like a joyful presence, kind of like, I don't know who the equivalent would be. Like a Speedball or something, you know, that was kind of his role in the Avengers. And I don't know, I personally liked it. So she talks to Peter. She's all pissed off. She goes into space. She's not sure what she wants to do. She's taking on these new responsibilities. And as she's thinking out in outer space, she's like, I'm taking the damn name. So she's going to be Captain Marvel. She gets back home and she is talking to a friend of hers who's going through chemo. And she, tells her about how a friend of hers has passed away, and her name was Helen Cobb. And Helen Cobb is basically a woman who pretty much inspired her when she was first becoming a pilot. Helen passes away. She goes to her funeral, and basically she has taken on the name Captain Marvel. She's now going to be wearing a mask, and I don't know how long that actually lasted, but there you go. That's the new Captain Marvel. And it's just a really quick read because that's how modern comics are. They take about 5 minutes.
So. I'm not a big fan of the mask.
I really love the original design. I thought it was very stunning. Dexter Soy was one of those artists. When I first read this, I was like, the blacks were so heavy. I just really hated the artwork. Mm. But going back, you know, 12 years later, looking through it, it's aged better than it looked at the time. You know?
Dexter Soy did a lot of good stuff in DC, though.
Yeah.
With the Deathstroke and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. He's definitely grown on me. But it was a very quick issue. It is what it is. But it laid the groundwork for basically her taking over the mantle of Captain Marvel and Monica.
Did you talk to Billy Batson about this decision?
You know, they talked to the DC lawyers and said,
I don't want to hear a word. We got that name.
So
you snooze, you lose.
Right. That was Captain Marvel number one, you know, whatever volume, I'm not sure, but 2012.
Well, Chris, do you have one? Do you want to go next? You want me to?
I can. Have you guys ever seen Black Rain? As Michael Douglas.
I want to say yes once a very long time ago.
I have not.
From 1989, directed by Ridley Scott. I had never really heard about this. It's not as well known as a lot of his other movies. It was the first film that he did after winning an Oscar for Wall Street. What interested me about it was that it involves Japan. Part of it was filmed in filmed in Osaka in Japan, and kind of gives you a chance to see late 80s Osaka. So that was kind of my main motivation for watching it, but it was an enjoyable film. I mean, it sort of one of those late 80s action police movies, very watchable kind of Sunday afternoon, catch it on cable channel kind of movie. You know, and I kind of associate Michael Douglas with, because of Wall Street and movies like that, I kind of associate him either with roles where he's playing a kind of straight-laced character, or one that is straight-laced but is kind of falling apart, like falling down.
Falling down is great.
You know, or being tempted out of his morals or something. But he does, I think he does adapt to this role, because so he plays NYPD detective, and you know, he's a bit rough. The film, kind of one of the early things that the film isn't concerned with is him being pressured by internal affairs, because they think that he and his partner took money out of evidence from a drug bust. And so he's mostly called into and is questioned about his partner, but it does, for a good like half of the film, the question of whether or not he took any money is sort of hanging out there. And this is his old partner. And so his current partner is played by Andy Garcia. They happen to be out for lunch when there's a meeting between some mafia type people and some Japanese people who turn out to be associated with Yakuza, so sort of the Japanese version, or you know, organized crime. And this Japanese man comes in and kills the Japanese men that are there and takes something from them. So they, you know, they go after him. And that is the event that sort of kicks off the rest of the film, when, you know, they, Michael Douglas and Andy Garcia's characters, they get sort of personally invested in catching this one particular Japanese guy, Koji Sato, his character's name is. So they end up getting permission to basically escort him back to Japan. But when they get to Japan, they are tricked by some Yakuza into turning him over to them instead of the actual Osaka police. And so they end up staying in Japan, and there's a lot of, they play off the cultural differences a lot between Japanese police and American police, and especially like Andy Garcia's character has a, he's not as short-tempered as Michael Douglas's character, so he's adapts a little bit better and contrasts Michael Douglas, who is has a really hard time and really bumps up against the rules and regulations, and you know, the lack of using firearms and things like that in Japan. But they end up working alongside a Japanese police officer, more directly played by Ken Takakura. He plays a inspector named Masamoto, that they call Mas. And he and Andy Garcia get along pretty well from the start, but him and Michael Douglas, Nick, his character's name is Nick, they don't get along very well at all. And so that's another thing that the film kind of, you know, it's one of those stories of two characters coming together and getting over their differences and finding common ground. And about halfway through the film, something happens, probably the most surprising event in the film happens, that is kind of the main catalyst for them coming together and working together more closely. So that's kind of the first half of the film. I won't get too much into the second half in case anybody wants to watch it, but the investigation deals primarily with counterfeit bills, and there's tension between the Yakuza that they brought back to Japan. He's kind of like a, also sort of a loose cannon, and is coming up against Japanese traditions. There's scenes with him and older Japanese Yakuza who are, you know, reprimanding him for being influenced by American ideals and American pursuit of money and doing things fast. And so it becomes more and more personal for Nick as the film goes on. And overall, you know, there wasn't anything super surprising or unusual that it did. It's just kind of solidly made police, the story that has a kind of the cultural clash aspect to it. You get to see some late 80s Osaka and hear some, you know, there's some Japanese language with subtitles in it, mostly in English. I did find, even though it follows kind of the beats that you'd expect, I do like stories where there's two characters who are initially really at odds. I tend to enjoy stories where you have that situation where they're overcoming their differences and end up finding that common ground and then working together. And so it does that pretty well with Nick and Matsumoto. I will say that without going too much into stuff from the later part of the film, the climax of the film was kind of, I found sort of dissatisfying. It was, didn't seem very inspired. It was, you know, I know Yakuza obviously are a organized crime division, so, you know, they are all about breaking the law. So, you know, the fact that there's so many guns involved in the climax of the film, I guess, could still be accurate. And, you know, because normally access to guns in Japan is extremely limited. Even the police don't carry them most of the time. So, but it just seemed kind of uninspired. But the resolution, the ending of the film was pretty satisfying after that. So I'd say it's, I watched it on Amazon Prime, you know, it's about 2 hours. And, you know, if it sounds like your genre of movie, I thought it was pretty, like I said, I thought Michael Douglas did actually inhabit the role of a more rough around the edges individual pretty well. So,
Chris, yeah, I think one of the reasons I had been leery of that one was because I was afraid it was going to do that Rising Sun thing where, you know, Japan is scary, and it sounds like that's not what it did at all.
Yeah, no, it's I thought it was, yeah, pretty I think it was pretty respectful. It kind of, you know, they definitely do show a lot of the differences between, you know, like I said, Nick, the character Nick, he comes up against the Japanese culture, right, and bounces off of it quite a bit, but I didn't feel like it was done in such a way that we're supposed to think that he's right and, oh, isn't this ridiculous how,
right,
you know, because there are some conversation, like there's in the middle of the film, there is that conversation that he and Matsumoto have, and he really is kind of taken to task in there. And that's kind of a learning moment from him, kind of comes from Matsumoto.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is definitely a lot of, maybe not a lot, but there is definitely discussion of and presentation, especially through Matsumoto, who is more amenable to them than a lot of like his superiors and stuff, but they're, mm-hmm, you know, his conversation about, you know, in Japan, we're more about the group than, yeah, the individual, and you can't just go off half-cocked and do whatever the hell you want. You know, there's consequences, and, like, your actions reflect on the others around you and that kind of thing. So, I think it's like a bit of a give and take, like both sides kind of learn from the other.
Yeah. I mean, I just know, was it, I said Rising Sun, but then there was like Gung Ho. There was a lot of the borderline anti-Japanese kind of movies in the 80s and 90s. So,
like, hey, I said, don't you badmouth Gung Ho.
So, so I wanted to make sure before I watched it that it wasn't just going to be like, we're scared of Japan, they're taking over the world kind of thing. And it definitely doesn't sound like that. So that's good.
I'm not saying Gung Ho is the most PC movie, but boy, do I enjoy that movie.
And that's okay. It's of its time.
Michael Keaton. Oh, boy. I love it.
But yeah, there was a lot of economic scare. That was the time, you know, when Japan had its bubble economy and they thought that they were going to, you know, just take over the world economically.
It's funny when you were describing Michael Douglas, just to throw in this last point about him, I always think of him as like the dirty movie man, because like when I was a kid, he was doing all the sexy movies like Basic Instinct and Fatal Attraction. And then he was like in Perfect Murder when I was in college. So I always thought he was like in the, you know, the adulterer type stuff.
It's funny.
Fatal Attraction is my favorite.
The Romancing the Stone.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Fatal Attraction, War of the Roses, Falling Down. Those are probably my top three of his movies. I love those movies. But Basic Instinct is really good too, so that's up there.
Yeah, if you like him just as an actor, I think this is a fun movie to watch. He's just kind of, I don't know. I don't know if he actually enjoyed making the movie, but he just seems to kind of be having fun being a badass. And,
Streets of San Francisco with Carl Malden.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Who's next? Me?
Sure, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, you were.
All right. So I'm going to talk about a book that only has one issue out, and it's from, let me see what, I think it's only got one comic in its whole, I can't find any existence of it, but it says it's in Buffalo, New York. So, hey, what do you know?
Oh, how do you like that?
I just saw on Facebook.
Escape Comics, 1994. So in our database, if you click on Escape Comics, you'll see a lot of them, but it's not the same because it jumps to a bunch of Kickstarters and other stuff. So I don't like know anything ever came out of Escape Comics but this. I'd be interested to find out.
It is the one I thought you were going to do, The Nightfall. Yeah,
It's spelled NYGHTFALL. And if you look at the cover, it has a very looking Bart Sears type anatomy to it, like just the way it's structured.
So she's got like an 8-pack in abs.
Yeah, an 8-pack in abs. The cover is what sold me. I didn't know what was going to be in the interior. I was buying some more grips, like Greatest Mercury Comics Action, and this was if you bought like 5 items, you'd get a discount, and I was like, okay, this looks like something that's in my wheelhouse. And it was. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's essentially a motorcycle gang driving to a cemetery to party. Like it's kind of like Rob's favorite Living Dead movie, where you have a bunch of gangbangers going to celebrate in the nude in the cemetery. Why not, right?
Right.
What?
I'm thinking of your favorite zombie movie where
Return
of the Living Dead, where what's her name goes out and takes all her clothes off, and all she has is those stocking warmers on.
Clothes off again
in the cemetery.
Well, these guys are doing the same thing, you know. They're riding their bikes up, they're gonna party in the cemetery. So this one head of the motorbike gang is going to, he goes out with Jade. He's like, let's go have some sex. And she goes, well, I got to go pee pee. And then she goes, she goes and
she goes,
You can see what kind of mood I'm in for comics lately. She doesn't say it like that. She says, I have to
I
pay
wish she
my.
did.
I did too. I never say, I gotta go pee pee.
She said, I had to pay my dues to Mother Nature. Okay, so it's a little more sophisticated than I gotta go pee
I
pee.
like your version much better.
And he's like, bloody hell, now what you caused me to do, love? He says, hurry back, sweets, because I can only stay idle for so long.
Oh boy.
But somehow this guy's bleeding from his last battle, so he's sitting there dripping onto this coffin, and somehow the ground just lets it go through like 10 feet. Like, his blood is just, this guy should be dead for how much blood he's losing. But he doesn't give a shit, right? He's gonna get some sex, so he doesn't care.
Right.
He's like, he severed an artery. It's draining into this casket, 12 feet below the ground. This casket's covered in chains and a cross, like a gold cross. And it seeps through the casket into a vampire, this female vampire that's on the cover of the issue. So she's actually getting life again. And then she, like, because that blood sort of woke her up, she's got the Bela Lugosi thing happening, so she could control. She's like, oh, dig me out of here, dig me out of here. Well, this burly guy that severed an artery that's gonna have sex decides to go dig. They're just conveniently shovels everywhere, so he just grabs a shovel and starts digging, and he's like, wow, look at all those gold crosses. We're gonna be rich, man. He says, get everybody, these are gonna be worth a million. So he takes the crosses off, which awakens the vampire, and she obviously, he gets a shotgun, shoots her, and she mists herself back together because he cuts out her midsection. She just pulls out his heart and starts drinking from it. She doesn't bite him in the neck. She just punctured his chest, pulls out his heart, and now she's got, her appetizer. The other motorbike guys are like, oh, we're gonna go kick some ass. Let's go over there. Our leader who severed his artery is getting his ass kicked. So they go out there and they try to stop her, and then you get a flashback scene of how she, in the past, in the 1800s or so, she was sort of raped by this rich guy, and then she fell into the arms of Dracula. And then Dracula's like, I'm gonna bite you once, bite you twice. The third time she turns into a vampire, she's gonna be immortal. But he's having sex with her this whole time. Well, he gets her pregnant, and he's got some dark things he's gonna do with the child. So she finds out about it and says, "Well, I gotta leave," so or protect the child. So she sends the child on a way in a carriage away from Dracula. And then it cuts back to the scene where she's there with the guy's heart, and the girl comes back from going pee pee. She just came back, and she's like, "Oh, don't kill me! I loved him. You killed Slash." And she's like, "Well, now you can work for me, And these other guys come, and they pull their guns and knives out, and they're called the Hellstalkers. And let's go kick some ass. And they don't do anything. They basically end up running. They end up getting killed and falling into crosses and splitting their heads open, and all kinds of stuff happens. And this girl on the motorcycle has to get him away from the biker, so she puts the vampire in the back seat, and they drive by Al Simmons's grave. How about that?
Wow,
And
really?
Al Simmons Spawn, it shows his dates, and then it has death. You know how they do that time thing with Spawn, where they have like
Oh,
five colon something? It has
That's
that
so
on the
smart.
grave site too. I'm
Yeah.
like, that's pretty cool, because I'm such a Spawn fan. I'm like,
That is
that's
cool.
badass.
I like that.
So she's gonna help this vampire essentially in the future, and then it just ends. Like, I'm like, I want more, man, but there is no more. So this
Dang.
was written by this was created by John Myers. He spelled it wrong. It's Meyers, but
I was about to ask, was he a relative?
He got the story, plot, and inks, and then the writer and the letterist was Trish Lampini, and pencils by Neil Kowalski. But man, it was fun as hell, man. I had
Wow.
so much fun. I was like, I God, I wish there was more of this. And it's like the art is not great. I mean, you could see some on my post of what the interiors look like, but
Yeah.
it's like a fun art for this style of book. And it's
It doesn't
color,
look
which is
bad.
very
It's got
unusual. Yeah.
that kind of Tim Vigil vibe to it.
Oh, definitely a Grips vibe. Like,
Yeah.
not necessarily Faust, because he had like a more refined detail pencil. But if you
Right.
look at his Grips stuff, it's definitely that vibe.
Yeah,
So yeah,
totally.
it was a heck of a lot of fun.
Hey.
I love getting books like this. Like, this is my thing, and I've been into like this what they call outlaw comics, like
Yeah.
Faust and Grips and all these like bloody heavy inks and violence and sex books lately, that North Star, Rebel, those kind of stuff. And this kind of fit in the realm. Like, it had the violence. It was in color, which was different, but it was a heck of a lot of fun, and it made me laugh in a couple spots, so that was entertaining.
Well, you have me at go pee pee, so.
Yeah.
My question should do is, y'all see if this cat's on the old X website, and if he is, ask him what those last four issues were going to be,
Yeah. I
so he
wanna
could see how it
know.
was going to end.
Yeah, I wanted to know what Dracula was gonna do with her, with his daughter, with the
Right.
child. Like, it seemed like they were building a lot of backstory for this character, so I don't know.
Very
It's
cool.
lost. It's kind of like the issue of The Guesser, if it ever comes out. It'll be the one issue, and then that's it.
You'll leave us hanging.
Yeah.
Right, I
I mean,
guess
it
my
sort of
turn.
suits it, right? Gotta leave them guessing.
Yeah,
Oh,
that's right.
well, I mean, I guess that's the point. Yeah, you're right.
You leave you wanting more. That's what a comic should do, right?
Yep.
So I'll just go over. I want to go over just a few of it. So I got back into watching some of the my Universal Horrors monster movie box set. I finally got into the late 40s and early 50s, which means that a couple of them that I watched back to back were Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein and Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man.
Oh,
So I've
those are
never
so
seen
good.
either one of them. Oh my God, I enjoyed the heck out of both. The first one, the initial one was Meet Frankenstein, but it's not just Frankenstein. Dracula's in it and
And
the
Wolfman.
Wolfman. Yeah.
It is
Yeah. So I'm like,
awesome.
wow. And the thing is like,
And it's a
you know, I
great
mean,
plot. It's a cool plot.
it's
Like, it
really
is
cool.
really imaginative. Like,
Bear
really cool.
and the two of them are just hilarious. But even more than all that is like, you know, you think of everything we think about with Dracula, it's because of how Bela Lugosi looked and talked,
Right.
right? I
Yeah.
mean, you're talking, you know, almost 100 years ago now, and you know, you have any like what the Hotel Transylvania animated series that my kids have seen and stuff, and they don't know why, you know, the vampire talks like that, but it's all because of this guy, right? But he only played Dracula in movies twice,
Yeah.
That's
the
wild.
original
Well,
and this.
actually, he was an Ed Wood's thing too. Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Bela Lugosi himself wasn't in it.
Yeah, he is.
No, he was dead already. Oh, yes. No,
No, he
I'm
was in
sorry. I
it.
thought you meant Ed Wood. Yeah. But he wasn't playing Dracula. He was playing very similar type
Oh, he
thing.
was
Yeah.
a vampire.
He was. You're right. But in terms of the actual named thing is and this comes out what like 20 years after, you know, the original Dracula. And it's so awesome to see him in it again because let me tell you, I've been watching these, you know, all these Dracula movies, and on in this box set.
You're right. He wasn't playing Dracula. It was another guy playing Dracula. He was playing the man that lost his wife in Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah. It's like the intro scene.
Yeah. So, it's so great to see him back in that role. There was a lot of different actors that were playing Dracula in a lot of those sequels, and they are not nearly as good.
And you have Lon Chaney Jr. too, the Lon original Chaney Wolfman.
He's got a special honor in that he was the only actor to play the Wolfman in all of those movies. Like, he never got recast or something because he didn't want to do it. Boris Karloff was not in that. This, unfortunately, is a different actor as
Frankenstein.
But it was just a fantastic. I'm not really going into the plot or anything, but it was just so fantastic to see this. And obviously, these are comedies, but so good. And then
Chet.
when he kept on opening to the casket.
Yeah, it's like Chet, and then he would be like Chet.
If anyone hasn't seen this, I recommend watching these. These are just fabulous.
Well, you know what I really love in the plot, though, is you have two beautiful, beautiful women after Costello.
Right.
Like one of them's an insurance agent because they lost the wax museum pieces. So he doesn't know that. And the other one wants to use his brain and put it into Frankenstein's monster.
Because it'd be easily controlled.
It's brilliant. And then Abbott is like, they're like, why do all these women want him? Like, there's a point where there's.
You want to give one to me?
Yeah. Oh. There's a point where he has three women. And he's like, well, just let me go with one. And he's like, no, I got them all. I got it all covered.
And you know what's cool with the plot, too, is that, like, Wolfman, Lon Chaney, he's teaming up with Abbott and Costello.
Oh, he's the hero. He's the hero, really.
Yeah. One of the
women is Dr. Frankenstein's niece or something like that.
Right, yeah, she's a bad guy that's
book
teamed
of bringing
up with
back,
Dracula.
Yeah, Dracula.
Yeah, to try to recreate the Frankenstein monster.
That's brilliant.
So entertaining.
I watched that movie every Halloween.
Oh, did
I,
you I really?
Just, yeah, I watched
yeah,
it.
Yeah, this is my first
I watched
time
it
I'm
again
going to watch
this
it
year.
Again for sure.
I just love it.
Yeah, it was great.
And I know you're going to talk about the Invisible Man one, but I watched Invisible Man for the first time.
Wasn't that one good too?
Yeah. Well, I can't. He's the monster that's killed more of them than anybody. He killed like 100, almost 200 people. He killed all those people in the train. He just derailed the train, and he went insane and killed all those people in the village. Like he was killing people left and right.
That's
in
funny.
The 40s. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, you know, this box set has – so Abbott and Costello did many of these, but this box set only has three, unfortunately, but does have the Invisible
Mummy.
Man, and then later comes the Mummy. Yeah, that's the other one.
I need to rewatch the Invisible Man one because I don't remember a lot of it, but I remember the Mummy one. And
I haven't seen the Mummy yet. That's actually next up, but – the Invisible Man one was pretty cool. It references the first movie and stuff and how, like, taking that serum, makes you invisible, so it starts making you lose your mind and go insane.
Did they use Vincent Price in that one, or did they use the original Invisible
that's
Man?
That's a good question. So at the end of the Frankenstein one, if you remember, they jump in I don't remember if they jump
it's
in the rowboat or the rowboat
boat.
Just there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's clearly Vincent Price's voice as the Invisible Man.
Yes.
He's not the Invisible Man
movie.
In the actual movie, but neither is the original guy. It references the original and how that original Invisible Man died and stuff. And what this one is it's this guy that's just been accused of killing someone. And he really didn't do it, but he's been framed. And so his whole thing is while he's trying to get evidence to show that he actually didn't commit the murder, he convinces his girlfriend's father, who is a scientist, to recreate the serum, and he becomes the Invisible Man, and he hires Abbott and Costello, who have just graduated from detective school, as private detectives to help him uncover the evidence that he's actually in it. And now we actually have a ticking clock as well, because he's already been warned that he's going to start to lose it and become psychotic the longer he remains invisible. And you can imagine, and so Mike, if you've seen it, but if you haven't, you can imagine all of the jokes and pratfalls and comedy that you can have with having somebody actually be invisible, along with, you know, Abbott and Costello, and they definitely play all that up. And but yeah, the Visible Man is actually the hero in this one as well, as he tries to uncover the plot of the murder and try to clear his own name. But I'm telling you, I didn't know what to expect with them, because I've never seen them, Mike. And boy, these two were fantastic. I'm really
they're an amazing like team. Those two, yeah. they have a couple more movies you should check out too, that are not Universal Monster related, but they're really good.
Do you know that happen to know the names?
I don't know. I'd have to go to IMDb and figure it out.
If you happen to look later or whatever, just send me a message, because I'll definitely put
them. Yeah, one of them's in the jungle. And that's a really good one. And then there's another one. I can't remember. But I'm a big fan of theirs.
But the
Frankenstein one is the best in terms of him. Because they have some really scary scenes. And he's like... Yeah. I love the scene where Frankenstein's monster's in that chair, and he like just sits in the chair. It's like he likes. That's not my hands. You know, like, he's like moving the fingers around, and he's like, I can't feel it.
Yes, for sure.
The one I always think of with them is Buck Privates, the army one. That one's good.
Yeah, what that was the other one I'm thinking.
Buck the military. Privates. It's like an army one. Yeah. That's good.
I'm writing that down. That's cool. And then the last one that we all watched together yesterday, because this is my favorite of the Universal Monsters.
Not Creature the best of Black movie. Lagoon.
Yes, exactly. Not the best movie, but my favorite monster. And Creature from the Black Lagoon. I think it's just the design of that costume and stuff. I just absolutely love that monster. Definitely my favorite. Even, you know, if I certainly admit, like, Frankenstein movie, the Dracula movie. I mean, I prefer those movies, but in terms of the design, I just love that character. And so, yeah, we all sat down and watched that one. Allie did not like it quite as much. Mm-hmm. I think she did not appreciate the sole female character's role in this movie was primarily to scream in shock and horror every single time she saw the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Yeah. And that's basically all she did.
Well, I'm surprised.
By the
I'm
third
surprised.
Time, Allie was rolling her eyes. So I can't say I blame her. Yeah. But yeah, I enjoy that one where they go.
I'm surprised they can still sit through with you for one of those movies.
Oh my gosh, Mike, we did those. We have the basic box set. We don't have the fancy one Rob has. But we watched all of them. I think we haven't got around to two of them. I think we still need to do Wolfman and Mummy. No, we did Wolfman last year. So we haven't done the Mummy yet. But except for Dracula, they liked all of them. They don't like Dracula. I think it's a little too slow.
Yeah, I love Dracula.
Dracula is by far my favorite. And not only is he my favorite, but he'd scare me the most. Like, there's something about Bela Lugosi that was so authentic. Like, he really looked like Dracula. And when they zoom in on his eyes and it's like that white thing. It's like...
I love that. I adore that movie.
But I was going to say, Rob, their three favorites were starting at the bottom, Creature from the Black Lagoon. They really liked the Gill Man. Number two, Invisible Man, which made me happy because that's one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, that was
the
good.
One that kills all the people.
Yeah, actually, he's like the most monster of all the monsters.
That's what I was shocked, because I have never seen it outside of Abbott Costello meet the Invisible Man, which is portrayed very differently. Like, yeah. he's a hero in this one, but he's like a doctor. He's a psycho in the original. Yeah.
But and the one that surprised me, because I didn't have very fond memories of it, but rewatching it, I loved it. They really liked the Universal Phantom of the Opera. That was their favorite.
That is not what I thought you were going to say.
I thought you were going to say Frankenstein for sure. I thought Frankenstein was going to be the one.
Yeah, but I wonder if it was because it was in color, but they really, really, my wife included, really liked the Phantom of the Opera.
Wow, I need to go watch that, because I've never seen the Phantom.
It's pretty
of the
good.
Opera.
It's better than I remembered.
Yeah.
The creature is so 50s.
It is.
Like sci-fi. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. Zach liked it. I told him to give him ratings. I don't remember what Zach gave it. He gave it a pretty high rating out of 1 through 10. Allie gave it a 3.
Oh, wow. Of the Frankenstein movies, though, Mike, I think everybody across the board, myself included, liked Bride the best.
Bride is an amazing movie.
Yeah,
that is a good one.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyhow, so you know, I don't know that I need to go into the plot for necessarily, but you know, it was. Maybe people haven't seen Creature from the Black Lagoon, but you know, they go down to the Amazon and because they have unearthed a strange fossil. Of a webbed hand, and sure enough, they go down there and they encounter a strange creature that starts killing the men, and finally, after like 5 tries, finally abducts the sole female of the movie, and the guys have to come and rescue her.
And then they end up having sex in their bathroom. Oh, wrong movie.
No, that does not happen.
There's a Roger Corman movie about like creatures of the Black Lagoon. I forget what it's called, but it's really worthwhile if you're a fan of the Black Lagoon.
Because it's the Shape of Water. Yes.
Yeah, The Shape of Water. The whole point of it was he wanted the monster to get the girl.
And, yeah.
And so like he wanted the Gill Man to actually hook up with the girl.
Because you feel bad for him.
You do feel bad for him. For the monsters all those movies.
Well, it's like King Kong. You poor Kong, right? I mean, he didn't want to hurt Jessica Lange.
And King Kong's very similar, yeah. I mean, they go diving after, you know, looking for stuff, looking for research, find a live creature, and one of the scientists is a complete jerk, and he harpoons him.
Yeah, let's cut him open. Let's make some fish fillets.
Yeah, and then they actually they shoot him to death at the end to save the girl.
Screw albacore, we could sell this guy for meat. You know?
Yeah.
Gross.
But yeah, I love the Creature of the Black Lagoon. So those are the three that I've watched. So I'm pretty much done with this huge box set that I probably got a couple years ago. I have the two feature sequels that I've never seen before. So I'm looking forward to that. And I have Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy, and that's it.
Cool.
Yeah, almost done.
Well, I can go again.
Yeah,
if you got
go
time.
For it.
Yeah, please.
So I think me and Mike talked about this last time when it was just the two of us. I was working on finishing off Shogun Warriors. I have finally gotten the last issues I needed. The one I read this morning was issue. Well, I actually read a couple this morning, but one of the ones I read this morning was issue 15. I thought it really stood out. I'm not sure how business was done in the olden days. Like, so this one's done by Stephen Grant and Mike Vosburg. Typically, that was a Munch and Trimpy joint. So I don't know if this was like a fill-in that they just had sitting in the drawer. I don't know how that worked, because it definitely, for one thing, it jumps in the middle of a storyline. Dr. DeMott, has anybody read the Godzilla series?
Yes, I have.
Okay,
it's pretty much S.H.I.E.L.D. versus Godzilla.
Okay, so there's a character that the Shogun Warriors are facing, Dr. Demonicus. I was wondering if maybe he was from the Godzilla series, because he struck me as very Godzilla. But I don't know. Anyway, so it was in the middle of this Dr. Demonicus series of stories. This issue happens, and it really doesn't fit with the rest of the series. So I wonder if this was like something where Monk and Trimpy got behind, or this was just a fill-in episode, and they were giving them the month off so they could work on something else. I don't know. Anyway, so like I say, Stephen Grant, Mike Vosburgh. I always think of Mike Vosburgh. Wasn't he like a – he was like a Justice League artist, wasn't he? I think it was a well, anyway. All right, so this is Shogun Warrior.
He did Team he did Team America.
Oh, okay.
Vosburgh.
Yeah.
I was just looking at something that I want to buy that's Mike Vosburgh. It fits into more of that adult theme, though.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it's called.
How come they never made another series of Shogun Warriors? We got a million of, you know, all those other ones, but nobody ever did a.
It was a toy that died on the vine, essentially.
I think part of it, too, is because it was a licensing issue where they had to use multiple licenses. So it was kind of like an All-Stars type thing. They took all these different giant robots from different anime series and manga series in Japan to make these toys.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so like Mazinger Z was Go Nagai. Raiden was another artist. And so I think part of it is just it was kind of a one-off deal because Godzilla was part of the toy line at one point as well.
Yeah, I have that Godzilla.
Yeah, so I think it probably just – it's probably too expensive, and they were just like, we're done, and they just never followed up. And like Mike said, it was ultimately a toy line that died, so they didn't feel the need. I think they kept Red Ronin.
Well, now that we're getting Micronauts, ROM, and Godzilla and Omnibus, I'm sure the Shogun Warriors is going to follow.
Oh, I would love it
that would be fantastic. Yeah. But like you said, they're going to need a lot of help with that, whether it's because of all the different characters, then, right?
Yeah, I would think so.
Okay.
But so basically this issue kicks off. They're kind of basically going through like X-Men Danger Room and the equivalent of Shogun Warriors doing that as they go out to the middle of like a rock quarry and they're kind of fighting just so that they can get in some practice back at the base after their fight. One of the guys is checking in. So you have Genji, she's the Asian character. You have Richard, who is a stuntman, and you have Ilongo, who is from, I can't remember if it was Nairobi. He was definitely from an African nation. I can't remember where. But anyway, so they're meeting up, and Richard's like, I gotta head off. So he just kind of cuts off and heads out, and it turns out something's going on, and then you have this really gross panel where his thumbnail pops open, and I don't know about y'all, but like nail stuff always bugs me. So he's got a transistor built into his fingernail, and for whatever reason, it just really grosses me out.
Yeah, that bothers me too. That and eyeballs.
Yeah, fingernails always are like a thing. Like, don't show me fingernails. And so it turns out it's not actually Richard Carson. It's some other guy. And he's, funnily enough, as we've talked about earlier with Chris's movie, he's working for the Yakuza. So the Yakuza have infiltrated the Shogun Warriors. They want to steal his Shogun. And they've kidnapped the real stuntman. And basically, they come up with this like harebrained scheme to get Dangard Ace. So Dangard Ace is one of the Shoguns. And everybody's checking in to their Shogun. And so Ilongo goes into his. Then Genji's going to go into hers. And Carson, the fake Carson's going to go into his. And as he's being transported into it, like I say, they come with this harebrained scheme like, okay, we're going to put you in this car. And then we're going to drive this car off the ledge. And when it drives off the ledge, it's going to hit the building. And when it hits the building, it's going to distract them so that we can have the fake Richard Carson take over the Shogun. So like I say, this is a lot of ifs and just kind of kooky. I'm like, it's like the weirdest thing in the world. You've already got this guy who's infiltrated it. I don't know why he can't just steal it. But anyway, so Carson is a stuntman. So he's not exactly just like some layman. So he's able to like drive the car with his feet. And so instead of crashing into the building, he runs off the cliff and runs into the building, into the control panel. So as the fake Richard Carson shooting up into, oh, I said Dangard. It was my bad. He was going into Raiding. Anyway, other than the headdress, Raiding and Dangard look pretty much exactly the same to me. But sorry, that sounded probably like racial towards robots. I apologize. So he goes into Raiding and he starts attacking the rest of the crew. And they're like, that's not him. And so Dangard Ace, flown by Ilongo, goes in and attacks him. So you get a big showdown where the two are fighting each other. Just kind of fight McFighterson. And Combatra comes in. I always like Combatra because that was the one that Genji flies and it can break into all the different pieces. They defeat the robot. Carson, the fake Carson, comes out. And he rips the mask off of him. And so it was just a cheap plastic mask. And he's like, ooh, you sure are ugly. And it's like the guy doesn't have the same build. The minute the mask comes off, his build like doubles. Like he's twice as big. Now he's short and he almost looks like a cross between like, what's the name of the guy from Metamorpho? The one who's like a Neanderthal?
Oh, yeah. What the hell is his name?
Well, anyway, all of a sudden he went from looking like exactly like the stuntman, like Mr. Million Buck Face, to looking like the Neanderthal from Metamorpho just by taking the mask off. The Yakuza infiltrate the building because, you know, crashing a car into a roof apparently didn't work, but they are easily held off by the Shogun warriors. Richard Carson, after they apprehend the fake Richard Carson, passes out. And he says, "Ugh, I need a vacation." And that's your story. And like I said, it was a fun little one-off issue, but it was really strange because, like I said, it doesn't fit in at all with the storyline. So I wonder if they were just behind or what have you, and this was just one of those that was sitting in a file cabinet, and they said, "Yeah, go ahead, we'll put this one out this month for issue number 15.
It's pretty awesome, though, how they did that. Like, yeah. So, in other words, we're not going to... We have an inventory story if we ever lose schedule, which is it's very forward thinking for like a monthly comic, you know.
So do you think they just did that? I guess it kind of shocked me that they did it with something that was so short lived. But I wonder if that was.
I don't because you have a license, which is a very fixed time. Yeah. So when you have a license, you got to get it in. Yeah.
So, I mean, for all they knew, it could have ran like ROM for, you know, 70 some issues. And they're like, we better have a couple of inventory stories. But
yeah
it was like I say, it was one that they just kind of slid into between the Demonica storyline. And it was a fun little issue. It's a good Java. Series.
It was Java.
Java. That's right. Yeah.
I had to look it up. It was driving me insane.
But yeah, just imagine like, you know, if you ripped the mask off of Rob and he turns into me or something like our the build completely changes and everything. It's just kind of funny.
All right, cool. Chris, I think you're up. If you're there.
Hi. Yeah. Sorry. Actually give me 2 minutes.
All right.
Sure, do you want to go next?
Get me.
I can go next.
Okay, either way.
All right, I'm going to do another vampire book.
Nice.
Tomb of Dracula. So I haven't read a lot of Tomb of Dracula. Now I'm starting to get into it a little bit. But I recently bought number, let's see, is it 19? More for a nostalgia reason because I owned the record. So surprisingly enough, this was one of my Marvel records that was done as a comic book back in the day. And it's a really odd one when you think about what's in this story, like why would they have chose this issue to be a record? It doesn't make a lot of sense. Because what happens in 18 is there's a fight with Werewolf by Night, and the Van Helsing, the daughter of the Van Helsing, is with Dracula. She has a book that could supposedly kill Dracula, but in this book, in this particular issue, they're in a snowstorm and they're both going to die because a helicopter crashed. And Dracula is keeping her alive basically to feed on her when he needs her the most. So he's dragging her along through the snow the whole time because the plane, the airplane, the helicopter crashed. And they're trying to survive in the snow, and she's waiting for the light to come because when the light comes, she can take advantage of the situation and try to kill her. But what ends up happening is she ends up getting away in a cave. They're in a cave, and she ends up getting away from Dracula. And another helicopter pilot, that's her friend, who's also a vampire hunter, rescues her. And instead of killing Dracula, like he's shooting like from the helicopter these wooden bullets at like machine gun pace. So they're like, it's like this Gatling gun, and it's shooting these wooden pellets at Dracula. So he's like, oh crap, what if one hits my heart? I better run away from this stuff. And she essentially is, he says, I could either kill Dracula now or save Van Helsing, and he chooses to save Van Helsing. And then they introduce this character, Dr. Sun, who looks like it's going to be a rival of Dracula, who revived a character that Dracula actually tried to kill, kind of like his Renfield at the in the comic book. But he tried to kill this character, and then they revived him, and now this Dr. Sun is a rivalry of Dracula, and he wants to be the king of the vampires. So you have all that going on, and then there's a brief scene in I read 19 and 20 in a row, so I'm kind of blending the two issues. But there's a scene in there with Blade, and it goes into the Blade piece where Blade was bit by Dracula, and he's not turning. So I'm beginning to wonder, not having read the original Blade, if Blade wasn't truly a vampire, because at this point in time, he was bit by Dracula, and he seems to be immune to the bite. Like he's not manifesting anything, and he knows that his mother was bitten during her pregnancy, and they're theorizing that, well, maybe he's immune to the vampire bite. So that was kind of interesting to me. So it makes me want to go back and, figure out like where Blade actually happened, because in the Blade movie, I do know that he was a vampire.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is really cool. It was unusual that they chose 19 to be a record because it's
Yes.
like the middle of a story.
Middle of a story, and it's called Snowbound from Hell. I just looked that up
Yeah,
for
but
a
I rem
Peter Pan record. That's funny. Like they had hell in the title.
Yeah, and it was very unusual because during this time they were doing a lot of the monster books in record
Yeah.
format. And I remember as a kid listening to the record, the snowstorm, they did really good sound effects. Like it was like, and there was like Dracula's awful voice there, and his there's a scene in where he laughs at Van Helsing. It's like, ho-ho-ho-ho-ho! It's really creepy. And I was always kind of scared because I had this record when I was a pretty young kid. So, it was, even though I couldn't make heads or tails of the story, it was pretty interesting and to read now in context of the other two issues.
Yeah, Tomb from Dracula, especially once you hit that Marv Wolfman, Gene Colan era, I would think it'd be hard to just pull out a random issue for the most part, because they really were a continuing story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff, though.
That's one of the first appearances I want to get is Tomb of Dracula 10. I mean, there's a couple of key books that I'm missing. First appearance of Blade, first appearance of Punisher, and first appearance of Wolverine that I'd really like to get.
For some reason, I thought I sold you a first appearance of Punisher, but I think that was Bullseye, wasn't it?
Sold
There we go.
me? I don't remember. It wasn't Punisher for sure.
No, Kirk had one that he was selling on mycomicshop.com
Yeah, I
for on
know.
consignment. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm I'm mixing them up. I had two Daredevil 131s. I don't know if you remember, Mike. It was a long time ago.
Oh, Daredevil 131's probably it then. That was a long time ago. I was trying to finish my Daredevil run.
Yeah.
Now I think it's been 10 years since I finished Daredevil.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I've got a Spidey 129, but it looks like I only have one of them. So, yeah, I was mixing them up.
All right. It's either you, Rob, or Chris.
Chris, you ready?
Yeah, I'm back. So I have another movie a bit older. Anyone seen The Night of the Hunter?
I have. Love that one.
Yeah, this one's from 1955, film noir, with Robert Mitchum, one of his probably better known roles. Along with Cape Fear, he's a handsome guy, but something
creepy
about
bastard.
His face, he just, with just the slightest smirk, you just really feel like he's up to no good, you know? You know, that was one thing about this character is that, Wikipedia describes him as a misogynistic serial killer. Yeah, so
most definitely
not a good guy.
As opposed to the feminist serial killers.
Right. Yeah.
Well, he's literally smacks the woman around at one point in the film. So yeah, he's definitely.
He's not very nice.
No, he's definitely no feminist.
Yeah, he's an abuser as well. But yeah, so they, in casting the film, you know, Gary Cooper was considered, and, you know, just he wasn't interested because of, you know, how he might be associated with the role, you know. So it wasn't a role that just any old actor would have taken on, but he's a pretty, this Harry Powell that he plays, it's a pretty iconic character, I would say, a pretty iconic villain, because like I said, he's described as a misogynistic serial killer, but he calls himself a preacher, and he, you know, quotes from the Bible, and I think also just makes up stuff that sounds biblical. That's kind of his cover for his grift. I feel like, you know, we've seen that kind of thing a lot more since then, and it might not have originated it, but just the whole idea of someone using, you know, a holy man as a cover for crimes or whatever. And so Harry Powell, he is arrested early in the film, and he ends up sharing a cell with another guy who we see arrested early in the film. This other guy, Ben Harper, he was married and had two kids, John and Pearl. And he's arrested after having stolen $10,000 from a bank. And before the police come to arrest him, he manages to hide the money, and he tells his kids, or either he tells them where they happen to see him, but either way, they know where the money's hidden, and he tells them, you know, don't ever tell anybody. Harry finds out while they're in prison together about this money. Because Harper tells him, because he's hanged because he killed some people in the process of robbing the bank. So he shares his secret with Harry. So when Harry gets out of prison, he goes after the money. And, you know, he's very charismatic, and he also uses that preacher role to get, you know, especially back in the 50s, people trusted a preacher or a priest, you know. And so he gets in with the townspeople. You know, there's an older couple that run a ice cream shop that that the kid's mother works at, and you know, the older woman is particularly smitten with Harry. But he also, you know, so he romances the kid's mother, and you know, all with the desire of getting into this money. And and you know, he emotionally manipulates the mother, Willa, using, you know, again, using biblical themes, and you know, making her feel guilty for her sins. And she kind of goes full bore into you know, evangelical tent revival Christianity. But he ends up, you know, as he gets further frustrated about trying to find this money and convince the kids, who are, the boy especially, John, is especially resistant and suspicious of Harry. He's a little bit older than Pearl, you know, but Pearl, she's too young to kind of see through Harry. And at least at first, but she still has a strong bond with her brother, so she's kind of torn between those two things. And John, he's pretty resistant. He's still real young, but he's old enough that he really looked up to his dad, even though his dad was a bank robber. You know, so he's kind of in that age where he's young, old enough to look up to his father, not old enough to see his father with clear eyes. And so he, you know, he kind of is more on to what Harry's up to. And yeah, so things escalate as Harry gets more and more frustrated in trying to find this money. And, you know, it has its moments where the acting is a little old-fashioned. There's some staging of some of the scenes where he's actively chasing after the children, where it's kind of hard to suspend your disbelief that he wouldn't have caught up to them, you know. Things like that where that you kind of have to look past. But the cinematography in this film is beautiful. I think that's my favorite thing about the whole thing. The time it was made, you know, silent films were still only a few decades past, and so it wasn't quite in vogue to draw inspiration from silent films. But this particular director, who I don't think made any other films, because at the time this wasn't received that well. And the cinematographer he worked with, they drew from silent films and like German expressionism and stuff. So there are some shots where I just wanted to pause the film and print it out as a poster. You know, there are just some beautiful, beautiful uses of black and white, just really stood out to me, that I really liked. And like I said, you know, second half of the film, things continue to progress along the route of escalating the conflict there. One character that I do want to mention that comes into it later on, that I think was another highlight of the film, is the Lillian Gish. Speaking of silent films, you know, I haven't seen, I don't think, any of her silent films, but she was, you know, in Birth of a Nation, which is, you know, a problematic film, but pretty well known, and a bunch of other, you know, in her younger years was very much a silent film actress. So in this, she is a bit older. I guess she would be, let's see, 1893 she was born, and this was 55. So she's in her late 50s and plays more of a matronly woman who takes in orphans and stray children and stuff like that. And she's a small woman. I don't know, but so I just found her, she made a presence in the film that I really enjoyed, because she's kind of this spitfire, this where she's you know, she's, for a good portion of the time that she's in the movie, she's armed with a large rifle.
Yeah,
because she's, you know, fighting to protect the children from Harry. And I don't know about you, Joe, but that was one of the things I really enjoyed about the films, was her standoff with him.
Yeah,
because she's so much smaller than he is and less physically imposing, but she really holds her own. She's 5'5", I guess, or was 5'5", I guess. So not super short, but just kind of thin and small. But she was a highlight for me.
I like that she was kind of progressive too. Like, even her attitudes towards sex in general, you know, she's like, with the teenage girl, she's like, oh, you're going to get in trouble. And, you know, and it was never like, you know, pray to God to get these sins out of your heads kind of a thing. It's like, you know, this is how things can go sideways if you keep going the way you're going. You know what I mean? It felt more like good advice that felt modern versus like, well, you know, the Bible says da 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 da. Even though she is a very religious character, ultimately, so.
That's true. Yeah. It wasn't as heavy handed. It was a bit more practical.
Yeah.
In her advice, which she does kind of contrast with Harry in that way. You know, he's using religion just as to get what he wants, you know.
Right.
And for her, it's more of a genuine thing. I enjoyed it. If not for any other reason than the filmmaking itself. But yeah, Robert Mitchum, though, he's something to be witnessed as well.
We watched it and Cape Fear, I won't say back to back, but pretty close together. And just the way he carries himself, just the menace that he has is really something to watch, because He's not the biggest dude in the world, but there's just something about him that, you know, when he's got that look on his face, he's just uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It's all acting and a bit of, you know, what he's able to do with his particular face, but it's not, you know, because he happens to be more physically imposing than the next guy or, you know, but yeah, he's an interesting actor. He was an interesting actor.
There's a good scene in there when he's talking to Pearl and he's showing her his switchblade cross, and where he pops the switchblade and the kid literally jumps out of fear, but then is also attracted to it and comes to it. And just that little scene, I don't know if that was genuine, the kid being freaked out or what, but that, I don't think a kid's is doing a great job acting, but that was just a really chilling moment, you know what I mean, like where he pops the knife at her. What else was I thinking as you were talking, the one to observations? Are you talking about beautiful scenes? There's the scene where she's in the water, Shelley Winters, she plays the woman he marries, and just it's absolutely gorgeous. There's a dead body underwater, but it's one of the prettiest shots in the whole thing, I think.
Yeah, did I even mention that he kills her? I might have skipped over that, but yeah.
Oops, sorry.
I wasn't. It's kind of the middle of the film. That wasn't something I was trying to leave out for spoilers. I was going to mention that he kills her and ties her body to a Model T and sinks it in the river.
But it's a gorgeous shot.
I do remember that shot definitely.
But what was the other thing? The one thing that we talk about suspension of disbelief that it's such a small community. Do you really think they could afford for three people to work in an ice cream shop? I thought that was kind of wild. I was like, where's the money coming in that they can even afford to pay mom, pop, and the woman with the two kids? I thought that was weird. Almost like it was a charity case or something. Because I'm like, how much business is this like 25 people town going to have? Was there anything else that one neat thing to Mike and Rob, because he is religious, quote unquote, and he's doing this purely for the money. When it comes to their marriage, I don't think they consummate, because he makes her feel really gross about herself, the fact that she would have desires. And then after that, she goes from wanting to sleep with him, because he doesn't want to sleep with her, he just wants the money. She actually becomes super religious up to the point he kills her. And he's so mean and manipulative. He makes her feel really gross for wanting to have a sexual relationship with her husband. And he makes her just feel ugly and like a dirty person. And he's a really wonderful man.
No, but that, thanks for mentioning that, because that is actually what kind of makes the character interesting and the film kind of fascinating at times is that aspect of the character. He has that misogynism and also just seemingly kind of a lack of sex drive or lust. That is actually a pretty fascinating scene in the film where, on their wedding night, she's ready to consummate the marriage and he has no interest. And that, it's kind of fascinating. You kind of want to dig into the character and kind of wonder why that is. She seems very much like the innocent woman who maybe just is not quite smart enough, not quite streetwise enough to really think for herself. She was with a guy who robbed a bank, and then she's with this guy, and like you said, he's able to just kind of manipulate her right into a total different way of living life.
But he's willing to use sex, though, because you see that again with the teenager, where he's like, he knows how to seduce, but once it goes past the seduction to the actual act, that's where he stops.
Yeah, it's not a seduction to get something else other than sex.
Yeah, because he uses the teenager to find where the kids are at only.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good movie. And yeah, I think you're right. Charles Laughton, I think, ended up being mostly known as an actor because the movie was such a bomb.
It's one of those things that kind of became famous after the fact.
Yep.
Do we have time for me to just do one more real quick? I got a comic book.
Yes. Sure.
I can hang for another 10 minutes.
All right. So Marvel 2-in-1, number 48, The Thing and the Jack of Hearts. Got this comic book from Christopher Ivey. And
what number was it?
48.
48.
It actually deals with some stuff going on from the previous issue where the Thing teamed up with the Yancey street gang. But I didn't read that. We start out with the Jack of Hearts basically practicing and tuning his powers in his own version of the Danger Room, I guess you would say. And it was so noticeable, maybe because of the lack of them these days, but even so, for the time when this came out in 1979, they're in the first like he's basically solo. He's talking to himself while he's running this obstacle course. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And the first 7 pages, and these are just it, counting the ads, so really 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So in the first 5 pages, there are no less than 7 editor's notes.
What?
With a little asterisk.
That's wild.
Yeah. See Last Dish. See Marvel Premiere number 44. See Deadly Hands of Kung Fu number 23. See Iron Man number 109 to 113.
Who is the editor on that issue?
See current issues of Iron Man. See Defenders 62 and 63. See Last Issue. Roger Stern.
Okay.
Holy
shit. He's on it.
They wanted to make sure that if you wanted to go back and see every previous appearance of the Jack of Hearts, you had them all listed here in the first 5 pages of this story.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they wanted you to go get that Iron Man issue, too.
The current issue, certainly. Yeah. So this is the writer's Bill Mantlow, and Chick Stone is the penciler. So he's running this course, and he's thinking to himself about, obviously, all his past dealings, as you can tell by all of the editor's notes. But when he wraps up, his butler has interrupted him to give him a letter. Now, he apparently has been dealing with this organization called the Corporation. And the Corporation, being a corporation, has sent him a business-like letter asking for another appointment to meet, whereas the last one, basically, they were battling, they were fighting. They'd like to have a second appointment over the matter of the formula of the zero fluid that gives Jack of Hearts his powers. And it says, if you're interested in meeting with us, as we are with you, present yourself at Pier 9 in the Hudson River line at midnight tonight. So he knows where he's going to be going. Now we cut back to the thing. The Thing and the Yancey Street Gang are all captured by this same corporation, and specifically Machine Smith, who had his first appearance the issue beforehand, and he's working for the corporation. And he's got them all captured, and the Thing's on this like X symbol thing that he's strung up, and he realizes quickly that if he exerts any type of force to try to get himself up, it's linked to the Yancey Street Gang, and they receive jolts of terrible pain. So he stops what he's doing. Machine Smith it wants to basically take over the Thing's mind. He wants to he feels that Thing is the strongest member, most powerful member of the Fantastic Four, and is going to use him to destroy the rest of the Fantastic Four in an effort then to take over the corporation himself. He's invented this headset that he is, when placed on somebody's head, he's able to control their actions. So he goes ahead and he puts this on the Thing's head, and the Thing is totally at his command. He's working with gangsters as well, and the gangsters test it out by blowing smoke in the Thing's face, and he doesn't react. He directs Thing to destroy some robots, and he does. He says, all right, you know, soon we're going to be able to control the corporation, but first we're going to destroy the Fantastic Four, but we have to have a test first. So that night, Jack of Hearts goes down to Pier 9, and he looks around. He sees that there's just one ship in the harbor, and it's just a yacht, and it seems to be riding low in the ocean, lower than a yacht normally would. And he's like, it's got to have a lot of stuff down in its hull. And as he's about to check that out from behind, they direct the Thing to get into place. Just before the Thing starts moving, though, the 3 or 4 silvery, no-faced robots come out from underneath the hold of the ship and start attacking the Jack of Hearts. Jack of Hearts is there's 3 or 4 of them, and he's able to pretty much dispatch most of them before the Thing comes running at him. And it takes Jack of Hearts a second to realize that Thing wasn't running to help, but actually punches Jack in the face. He then the Thing then grabs the mast of the ship, breaks it in half, and starts hitting Jack of Hearts around like a baseball bat, knocking him all over the place. And Jack of Hearts finally has had enough of it, and as he's flying, being knocked away from the boat, he comes flying back saying, okay, this now we mean business. The gangster his name's Carnation, and Machine Smith are congratulating each other because it seems to be going very well. However, Machine Smith says, okay, we're ready to abandon the ship. Let's get off of here. The one gangster runs the one direction because he's going to actually set off explosives soon. So the whole thing will blow up shortly after they leave. However, he runs past the Yancey Street gang, and one of them is able to lift up his legs and kind of get that guy in a chokehold with his legs and kind of tosses him into the control panel, which frees the Yancey Street gang. So the entire gang start making short work of all the gangsters that are still in the ship down below, and they pretty much are able to knock them all out. We cut back to the Thing and Jack of Hearts, who are still going at it on above, and he thinks Jack legitimately thinks he's fighting another android that looks like the Thing. As a matter of fact, when he looks at the Thing's head, he sees what seems to be a seam running through it. In other words, the helmet that they put on him looks like the Thing's regular head, and he thinks that it's an obvious seam of an android. So he blasts at that and destroys the headset. And after being kind of in a daze for a second, the Thing starts to come through. But before that happens, we cut back to Carnation and Machine Smith saying, okay, you know what? It's time for us to get out of here. Carnation's like, wait a minute, aren't you upset about this? You wanted the Thing to destroy the Fantastic Four. And Machine Smith's like, you know, it doesn't really make a difference who's going to eliminate Fantastic Four as long as they're eliminated. And if Jack of Hearts is more capable, then, you know, then so be it. We need that secret of the Zero Fluid anyhow. I'll go ahead and put an alpha headset on Jack of Hearts and he'll do the job. Just as they make this decision, the Yancey Street Gang show up and they start, they knock out the gangster Carnation. They hit Machine Smith and he falls over and it looks like he's knocked straight out. And just then Thing comes to, him and Jack go down back into the hold and they meet up with the gang. And they start, Jack starts investigating Machine Smith, like, oh my God, he's as cold as ice. He doesn't have a pulse. And the gang is like, we barely tapped him. Like, what? There's no way possible that this guy's dead from that punch. He's like, I believe you, but what's going on? And then he starts shaking him and he falls apart. So this is where we would learn that the Machine Smith is another robot. And, like, all right, well, we're going to have to call the cops. And just a little amusing end to the story is that, you know, the NC Street Gang and Thing go at it all the time. There's some love. When they thought that the Thing was done for, they were very upset. But now that they know he's okay, they're giving him the business again. And, you know, they say, oh, you know, we've been through a lot. So just to show there's no hard feelings, here's a Havana cigar, and they give it to the Thing and light it for him. And of course,
it explode.
Yeah, of course. And the last thing is, all right, he says, all right, wise guys, this means war. And that's actually the end of the story. So what more happens with the corporation, with Machine Smith, so on? That seems to be more of a, maybe it's more of a Jack of Hearts story that comes later with more Jack of Hearts. The next issue is the Thing in Doctor Strange, and I'm not sure if it runs the same story, but I would be willing to bet that it's a brand new story, because this one seemed to pretty well ended in terms of how the Thing was concerned. And I think if you want more of what was going to happen here, you'd have to follow wherever Jack of Hearts shows up next. But yeah, it was very straightforward, just pretty much straightforward battle. No, not really any side plots going on, but an enjoyable story.
Classic. Seems like a tough character to draw. So much going on.
I've heard so many artists like really, really be angry about that costume.
Well, Ben's a lot of line work too, I imagine. You know.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. You can get away with a lot of stuff, though, I think, with Ben.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, we can wrap this one up. I hope you guys have a good Thanksgiving week.
You too.
You too. Happy Thanksgiving, yes.
We will get back probably for, is this 199 and we got 200?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is the first time I think all four of us have been on for 3 years. I don't know. It seems like a long time.
It's been a while.
Last time I did one was in August, and that was just with Mike. So it's been a while since I talked to you.
It's been a while. So
it's nice to have
I'm glad all of us were able to do this before the holidays, and I hope you guys have a good, safe holiday. I hope the COVID thing isn't serious and everybody's
okay.
That's what
my dad actually called about. He said, well, we're still tested positive, but it's been many days. I think after a certain number of days, you're good to go back out into the world.
Yeah.
And you're not, I don't think you're necessarily supposed to keep testing over and over again, but he is. It's been over 8 days, I believe, for him. But I got to talk to Stacy. I'm sure it'll be fine.
All right. Well, let's wrap this one up. You can reach me at MythMaking. Miss MythMaking.
Take it over.
I've opened up Chris's account. Chris is no longer on Twitter. But you can reach me at Mike Myers Brunch. At Iowa's Joe is Joe. And at Rob Krieger. Sound like Seeger is on Twitter and X and Blue Sky, I believe. Mm-hmm. So you could find Geek Brunch Podcast on Facebook. If you click the like button, you can follow the episode threads there. Or go to our very old-looking website, which is Geek Brunch Podcast, and see a cup of coffee on there and read some comics with us. But that's where we will be. And I hope you guys have a good holiday. I hope all the listeners have a good and safe Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you soon.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.